Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the continuation of the December meeting of the California Fish and Game Commission. I'm Richard Rogers, president of the commission from the Santa Barbara area in Carpinteria. Sitting immediately to my right is Commissioner Sutton, Michael Sutton from Monterey. Sitting right over there on my left is Commissioner Cindy Gustafson, vice president of the commission from Tahoe City. And to her left is Jim Kellogg. Commissioner Kellogg is from Concord. And between all of us right here is the executive director, John Carlson. We have deputy executive directors, Adriana Shea over here, John Fisher, who is talking to John Carlson. We have our deputy attorney general, Bill Cunningham. Sitting on his left is Sonke Mastrup, deputy director of the department. As far as our staff is concerned, also we have Sherry Cole. At least she was here a minute ago. There she is. And Kathy Przinski, and that's it. And then in the standing in the room should be Deputy Director of the Law Enforcement Division, Chief Nancy Foley. I think she's, at least she was here. Captain Roland Takayama, who is standing right there by the door. Neil Manji is sitting back there. He's chief of fisheries branch, and Dr. Eric Loft is also here, chief of the wildlife branch. And, of course, Assistant Chief Rob Allen, who was here yesterday as well. John, take it away.
Thank you, President Rogers. A few housekeeping things I'd like to remind everyone. One is we are live-streamed internet, and so everything you say is going to, you know, the whole meeting will be going on film, and it will be archived and available through our website. If you want to view it at a later date, just go through our website, through the links, and you can get there. It's a free service. So keep that in mind. We all try to keep that in mind while we're speaking, that we're being filmed and it's going on tape. The start of this morning, we are going to go back to an item that was held over from yesterday. And that was on the agenda item number 3, receipt of the final revised draft master plan for marine protected areas with possible adoption in February. I also need to let everyone know, if you want to speak on a agenda item, there are green cards at the out in the hallway, and please fill those out and hand them into staff up here at the dais. We have an aggregate time limit of 10 minutes per day across all the agenda items, so choose your items, and then write down the specific numbers that you'd like to speak on. So we'll start with item 3, receipt of the final revised draft master plan for marine protected areas with possible adoption in February. We have the executive director of the Blue Ribbon Task Force, Ken Weissman, here, who is going to speak on it. And we have Adriana Shea, our deputy executive director, to help explain.
Good morning, Commissioners, and I think Ken is here to offer assistance if there should be any questions, and John Ugertz is here from the department as well as a resource. Just to give you a bit of background, we received the department's summary of comments in August of this year and met with the Blue Ribbon Task Force and received their suggestions in September of this year. And since your last meeting, we have utilized a technical writer as an intermediary between to help the department and the commission staff and the Blue Ribbon Task Force staff really work on hammering this document out, and it's proven to be a larger undertaking than we originally thought. So you did receive a hard copy draft today. It will be posted to our website by close of business today, staff tells me. And the department's website, and we'll have a link on our website. Thanks. There are still some cleanups that we need to continue with this document, but we wanted to get a hard copy out. Things like page numbering, and because we reordered appendices and things like that, we want to make sure that this is really bulletproof before adoption, hopefully, which will be scheduled at our February meeting. So this should give constituents and all interested ample time to review the document before that. So you are just receiving it for the first time in its current form.
Ken? Welcome.
Secret. Good morning. Yes, we have tried to keep the focus on the big master plan concept and not get lost in details about this guidance document, which you may probably continue to amend as we develop our MLPA process, and that process continues to move forward. And I think this is a good reflection of where we are to adopt the basic framework, but it's the appendices that the department and the initiative, you know, bring to you and that you adopt that become really the living important parts of this document. And we think this guidance has been good. We continue to I think improve our science. We're hopeful we're going to be able to do some modeling this coming year, and we'll be able to, within the next year, bring back suggestions and changes that even enhance this document more and keep it a living and positive item.
And I'm told you were all just handed a memo from the department outlining some of the major and minor changes, and this was a result of Melissa Miller-Henson, John Ugaritz, the technical writer, and myself all working on this. So it's a quick outline of changes that were to be made. If you have any questions, please let us know. And also, we have a joint meeting with the Blurban Task Force coming up.
Correct. We have scheduled February 13th, which will be a joint meeting with the task force, which will be the time that our regional stakeholders group will be making their first proposals. This will give the commission and the task force a chance to react to them. The task force then will continue to meet the second day, being able to incorporate that first day's discussion and comments, and we think we'll have a stronger process. Again, that was one of our lessons learned, was get the commission involved earlier and understanding, and we think that the stakeholder group is very excited about the idea. They'll be able to present the first draft, and then we'll have time to get your comments and actually incorporate it in further drafts.
Thank you, Ken. Sankey, you have a comment?
Yeah, I'd just like to elaborate on the memo you just received from us. This document, it's been kind of difficult to follow its path, and what this memo does is gives you both a chronology and an outline of the changes that have occurred to the original draft you adopted. So just in case you wonder where you've come from, this kind of gives you a quick, short.
And I've wondered that for years. Thank you, Sankey.
You're welcome.
Question?
Ken, I think the last time we saw this document, there were a number of color-coded annotations of various suggestions and edits that the Blue Ribbon Task Force and other stakeholders had proposed. Does what we have before us now incorporate many of those edits?
All of those edits are incorporated, and basically the two versions that the department had done, and then the comments of the Blue Ribbon Task Force are incorporated into this. And it was when we piled all those on together that we realized we needed to get some sorting it out, and that's what we're doing. But just keeping it to those three, the recommendations of the department and the Blue Ribbon Task Force is what you have before you.
Any further questions or comments from the commission? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ken.
We have two speaker cards left over from yesterday, and as of this morning, I haven't received any new ones. I don't know if Tom Raftikin is still in the audience. I don't see him this morning. If he's not present, okay. So he's not here. So then our only other speaker on this issue is Paul Weakland.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland. I think before we start any of this master plan things, you should talk about how long it's taken you to get here. I know it's been a long travel. And still, some of our questions haven't been answered. For instance, there is no criteria to failure in your master plan. How do you effectively judge, gauge, or evaluate this flawed concepts or non-provable theories? We have been told that there's no measurable or detectable benefits of all the marine protected areas. Oh, it's not a marine protected area. That's a misnomer. It's a no fishing zone. It does not protect the resource from anything but fishing. And your master plan ignores the economic impact on the fishermen and the fishing communities, but it's a boon for the grant-sucking parasites and the pseudo-scientists that say this is the only way to protect the resource. We would like to have entered the handout that we handed in yesterday at the public forum. The public forum is to hand out any and all materials on the agenda. I'd like you to take out your handout now and refer to the third page. If you would, the questions are, how does closing an area to fishing protect the resource from environmental changes like El Nino, warming, or storms? How does closing an area to fishing protect from oil spills, pollution, urban or agricultural runoff, the lack of enforcement, failed federal policies like overpopulation of seals, sea lions, and elephant seals, the introduction of sea otters, a failed zonal concepts, mismanagement since 1870. The fishermen of the state of California have fished only under strict regulations and laws set down by the State Fish and Game Commission. And now we are being punished for following those very same laws that were set down. How do you prevent from the introduction of disease, parasites, invasive species, unethical researchers, military operations, global sonar, toxin, construction projects, power plants, the refusal to acknowledge variables such as aquaculture problems, botched experiments such as outplantings with withering syndrome. Do anything but punish fishermen, ruin people's lives, and destroy families. I'd like to use as my example black abalones. Black abalones have been closed throughout the whole state for fishing for over 14 years. And what is the outcome? Now you've elevated to endangered species and extinction. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Weakland. I'd actually love to see a document sometime in government service that would do 5% of what Paul suggests this one doesn't do. That'd be delightful at some point in time. So, anyway, move on.
That moves us to today's agenda. Item 13. Announcement of results from yesterday's executive session.
Good morning, Mr. President, members of the Commission. My name is Bill Cunningham. I am a Deputy Attorney General and Counsel for the California Fish and Game Commission. I want to report that we did meet in executive session yesterday during our lunch hour. This executive session was conducted pursuant to Government Code Section 11-126, in which the Commission can meet with its lawyers to discuss matters in litigation or pending litigation. I'd like to report we did discuss the items that were identified on our agenda, but no action was taken. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Any questions or comments? John?
And we have no public speaker cards for that item. Moving on to item 14, Channel Islands MPA's annual monitoring update. And John Ugritz from the Department's Marine Region will give this presentation.
Good morning, Mr. President, Commissioners. John Ugretz with Department of Fish and Game. And today's presentation marks the fourth annual monitoring update since this commission adopted new marine protected areas at the Channel Islands. This year's presentation will be a little foreshortened, and you'll sort of hear why at the end of the presentation, but to give you a preview of that, we're planning the fifth annual update, which pursuant to the monitoring plan for Channel Islands, we had told the Commission that after 5 years we would bring you a major review of results. So I'll explain how we're preparing for that and when you're going to start seeing some of those major results at Channel Islands. So if I could have the presentation, Channel Islands monitoring update.
You got a blank look back, John.
I know Steve put it in there. I'll just go ahead and start while they're looking for it. Maybe.
Hang on just a second.
Yes. You got to get the boss out for it.
Yeah, Steve, obviously we should have these things chronologically teed up and ready to go.
Come on, Steve. Well, anyway, The department has continued to work with outside groups to review both the biological and socioeconomic impacts of these marine protected areas of the Channel Islands. And, of course, our overall goal has been to provide you with understanding and the ability to adaptively manage. The Channel Islands have given us a very good example.
Are we getting
for other
it,
areas.
Steve?
Yeah.
Excuse me.
Okay.
There we go. All right. Thank you, Steve.
Okay.
Sorry, John.
So starting with trends in commercial fisheries, you should be getting familiar with the various graphics I'm going to show you. And I'll point out that, as we've always stated, these are a very simple view of changes in landings. They don't represent a full socioeconomic analysis. But for the fifth annual review next year, you will be getting much more complex analyses of landings and trends in locations of fishing and effort. But what these graphs do show is the estimated maximum potential loss to fisheries at the Channel Islands. And in this graphic, how things have changed at the Channel Islands over the last 4 years versus how things have changed in the rest of Southern California. Looking at the Channel Islands alone doesn't really give you the whole picture because things might be declining bite-wide in Southern California.
John, so, could I? I'm sorry for interrupting you, but when you look at these figures, does this take into account any sort of effects of the MPAs on the recovery of any of these species, or is that are we too early to say?
Potentially, yes, and I'll explain some of that as I go along. And again, for the fifth year review, we're going to look much more closely at how things have changed biologically and how does that compare to how things have changed in terms of fisheries. So going back to the slides, what you see is that for, at this point, four of the species that had the highest maximum potential loss in the environmental review of the Channel Islands MPAs have actually increased their landings at Channel Islands since MPAs were established. So for things like crab, where the maximum potential loss was estimated at about 15% of the ongoing catch, it's actually increased by 48%. And I highlight in red those species that were in Southern California, even though things have increased at the Channel Islands, have actually decreased in Southern California. So this is a pretty clear example not of a marine protected area effect, and I want to emphasize that, but of the fact that the estimated maximum potential loss did not occur at the Channel Islands. Sea cucumber, it did decrease at Channel Islands, but you see it decreased less than the estimated amount, while it actually did increase in Southern California. Again, This is not necessarily an MPA effect, but it's something that might merit closer review in terms of is it a potential effect of marine protected areas. And then finally, certain species did decrease their landings at Channel Islands, in particular California sheephead and rockfish. And for these species, as I've explained in previous reviews, there's been lots of other regulatory change since just prior to the implementation of marine protected areas, primarily depth restrictions on fishing and also seasonal changes. And those can help explain decreases at the Channel Islands where there is less shallow water to fish in. When you have a depth restriction, that's going to impact the island areas greater than the rest of Southern California. What you'll also see, though, is that while overall there's been a decrease in commercial landings in these species, in some cases the trend is actually turning back up and landings are increasing. So going to the commercial fisheries, I'm just going to quickly review these. For spiny lobster and rock crab, what you see is that the trend, the red part of the graph is the percent of the landings in Southern California coming from the Channel Islands, and the blue part is the percent coming from the rest of Southern California. Spiny lobster has maintained very close to the average amount of landings coming out of the Channel Islands, and I'll point out in this first graphic that this is not total landings, it's the percentage of landings. So it's saying regardless of whether total landings have gone up or down, what part of those landings is coming from the Channel Islands. Rock crab, as you see, has actually been above the average since MPAs were implemented and the year before, and has maintained that at a fairly high level. In other words, the landings over the past 4 years have been above the average consistently. Squid, this is a fishery that is highly variable. It's dependent quite a bit on where the squid are. Fishing moves from one location in the state to another, and in Southern California, sometimes the bulk of the landings come from Catalina Island and the southern regions, and sometimes from the Channel Islands. And that trend continues, though I would point out that at least two of the years post-marine protected area implementation have been actually the highest seasons in terms of percent of landings coming from Channel Islands. One has been the lowest, so a highly variable fishery with lots of other factors in play.
It's actually flooded with shrimp as we're shrimp with squid as we're speaking right now. All the shallow areas around Santa Cruz are just flooded with
lots of spawning going on. Yeah.
All over the place.
So in terms of the next two species, sheephead and rockfish, as I mentioned, the trend has been for a decline in landings, though that trend, especially for rockfish, began well before the marine protected areas were implemented. But I would point out that both in the case of rockfish and sheephead, the trend, sheephead this last year turned around a little bit and increased slightly, and for rockfish has been up a little bit compared to the first year after marine protected area implementation. So likely some other factors going on here. And finally, sea urchin and sea cucumber, two fisheries that have increased in general. Sea cucumber was down a little bit this year, which created that downward trend that I pointed out. And sea urchin has been up significantly. And as I've mentioned in previous years, most likely due to very good kelp at the Channel Islands in the past several years. Lots of kelp mean the sea urchins have better roe, therefore they're more acceptable to the fishery. Similar reviews can be done for recreational fishing trends. The data I'm going to show are from the party boat log data only. So this is not from our California Recreational Fisheries Survey data. We will be presenting some of those data at the final five-year review. Looking at ocean whitefish, and I can't even read that, another species. Trends are very stable, very much near the average at the Channel Islands compared to Southern California. Kelp bass and white sea bass. Kelp bass is sort of a marginal species at the Northern Channel Islands. It's at the edge of its range there. It's low but stable in terms of percent of landings. But white sea bass, as you see, has had significantly higher catch. It's been great fishing for white sea bass. We do think that's due to some other regulatory measures, in particular moving gill nets outside of the near shore area that has increased the catch of white sea bass in the recreational fishery over the past many years.
That fishery is a terrific success.
It's going well, and everybody's happy about that.
Well, and they're catching 40 to 60 pound fish, too. That's phenomenal.
So going on, looking at sheephead and lingcod, as I mentioned, these are the species, the bottom fish species, where catches have declined in general at the Channel Islands. But as you see, sheephead is low but fairly stable in terms of catch trends compared to Southern California. And lingcod has been increasing since the second year after MPA implementation. For biological monitoring, today I'm not going to talk much about it at all, other than to say that in February, as I'll show in a minute, we're going to have a very major review of the results. The reason I do show a spiny lobster here is that in terms of species where you could expect a change in a short period of time because of their growth rates and age at maturity, we actually are starting to see those trends. And populations in the MPAs appear to be increasing compared to areas outside the MPAs. For the five-year monitoring review, we've taken a very careful approach and one that's include a lot of scientific input and review. We started by a three-day workshop, so 9 days of meetings with more than 25 scientists participating at the National Center for Ecological Analysis and Synthesis in Santa Barbara. The purpose of these workshops was to discuss the various results of different monitoring programs and look at how those results could be analyzed in comparison with each other and in comparison with other outside factors. We've looked not only at biological changes, and I think this is important given some of the comments you heard yesterday, but also how management has done, outreach and education, as well as compliance and enforcement. We've looked at the ecological and biological changes, and also looking at the socioeconomic changes, in particular some much more careful analysis of where people are fishing, how those patterns in effort have changed, and what you might be able to say about them. There will be 17 presenters giving presentations on the results of monitoring, and those presentations will be given at a special session of the California Island Symposium on February 7th and 8th, 2008 in Ventura, California. This does overlap with a commission meeting. It's a symposium that's put on by the National Park Service on about a three-year basis every third year. And their dates were set, so we didn't have an opportunity to choose a different date. That said, the proceedings of this workshop are going to be provided to you in a written format, and they will form the basis of the five-year review you receive in December. So this is really a prelude to what you will receive in December. The presentations will be looking at changes in abundance size and biomass, changes in species composition and ecosystem function, changes in marine habitats, spillover and movement of fish and invertebrates, changes in catch per unit effort, and changes in vessel distributions, as I mentioned. The scientists are very interested in publishing their results, so beyond the proceedings of the symposium, there will likely be a series of peer-reviewed published research. And all of this, you know, we've heard lots of comments about not knowing anything about existing marine protected areas in California. At your five-year review in December of 2008, you will know a significantly amount more about the impacts of a major change in marine protected areas that formed really the first portion of the statewide network. And I think you'll be very pleased with those results. That's it.
Okay. Are there any questions? Mr. Sutton?
A quick comment, John. At last weekend at the Pew Fellows in Marine Conservation meeting in Morro Bay, Steve Gaines presented some preliminary data on biological monitoring and recovery of lobster and sheephead. It looked very promising. I was really encouraged. I take it that's going to form part of your February
exactly,
report.
Yeah. Those are the same data that are being reviewed, and I debated whether to steal the thunder of February and show those results today. And actually, given that the scientists are really in the midst of their analysis right now, I think it's appropriate to hold off till February to see it.
It was just a preview, but what was interesting to me is that they're actually looking at, they're taking data from far outside the reserves, near, right on the edge, just inside, and far inside. So you really have the whole spectrum of to compare.
Right, and one of the trends that's being shown, which is very consistent with studies around the world, is that it's not a knife edge. You don't get this dramatic change at the edge of the reserve, which actually starts looking at the spillover, where you get more of a bell curve, and the further into the middle of the reserve, the higher abundances are, and the further you get away from the middle of the reserve, the lower they are. But outside, you actually do have increases compared to far outside.
Just one other question. Are you or any other of the wardens and so forth starting to see any fishing the line, so to speak, where...
Well, we've certainly seen that at Anacapa, and there was already evidence of that, excuse me, with the very small MPA that had been in place for about 30 years at Anacapa before this took place. And you can actually basically outline the MPA in lobster traps during lobster season, and you can see hook and line fishing boats, recreational and commercial, fishing the edges when the appropriate seasons are in place. So we are seeing some of that. One of the data sources that will be reviewed at the February meeting is the sanctuary's aerial monitoring program. So rather than relying on fish landings data that the department collects, there's actually visual surveys of where boats are fishing. There's some very interesting results there, too.
Any further questions? I have one. John, one of the, as you know intimately, and everyone involved, all of us up here know intimately, One of the criticisms of MPAs is that it will concentrate effort in certain areas outside the MPAs, or the reserves, let's call it reserves, and thus decimate those areas. clearly the recreational party boats all have GPS and they all go to very particular places. I'm out there quite often and I see them in the Channel Islands going to the same places, same boats, you know, putting 25 rods on top of a rock pile and fishing it out. Fairly clear. How closely are we monitoring the recreational party boats to determine whether that is actually damaging the resource or not, or what effect the MBAs have had on that?
There's really three data sets that come into play. One would be the party boat logbooks, but those don't get to a specific fishing location. They're just a block data, like the commercial data.
But taken in aggregate, they're probably a good surrogate.
Right. Second is the onboard observations from California Recreational Fisheries Survey, which gives GPS coordinates, along with that sanctuary aerial monitoring, which gives GPS coordinates. So you can visually see exactly where the effort lies. That is coupled by the third data set, which is this biological monitoring data. And if fishing the line and concentration of effort outside of MPAs were creating a negative environmental impact, you would expect to see that importantly in the biological data. You would see areas outside MPAs where the trend is going down dramatically. And as I just mentioned, that doesn't appear to be happening, especially directly adjacent to MPAs where the heaviest fishing the line effort does occur. As is seen in other MPAs around the world, you actually have slight increases directly adjacent to MPAs from the spillover, and you don't, even though people are fishing harder there, and it is true that people fish harder outside the MPAs near them, you actually don't see a negative impact of that. They're actually reaping the benefit of the marine.
The reason I'm familiar with the data, and the reason that I'm bringing this up is that it's very, very important for us to focus on this as we go forward installing the MLPA down throughout, I mean, for example, well, this current one, and then, of course, coming from Point Conception down to the border with Mexico. The reason is it's almost like that television program Mythbusters. It is a serious myth that has been bought into by a large number of recreational and commercial fishermen. And if the data shows that that whole concept is not true, it's going to be very important to focus on that and to be able to defend that position if, in fact, it is accurate scientifically. Very important to do that because it will aid the implementation of the MLPA process going on down because people will realize that this is actually a net benefit, which those of us who've been involved with it believe it will be.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously we've been cautious in presenting any results until now. We feel like from a scientific perspective we want to be sure what we're saying is scientifically accurate regardless of what the trends look like, which do look positive.
Good.
I think the February workshop and the December commission review will very clearly show some of those things.
Thank you. I also
think that it's important to point out and for people to remember that this commission is keenly aware of those concerns, and it's certainly the department's view that you take those into account. We're not talking about closing the whole coast or closing even such a high percentage of the coast that there are no places to fish outside the MPAs. And, you know, I think even already in the Central Coast where there were grave concerns about not having anywhere to fish because the MPAs purportedly took up all the good spots, I've had party boat skippers call me, ask to see the maps, discuss the maps, and say, oh, I didn't ever fish in that spot anyway. I fish north of there. And they were very pleased to see what you had selected and that their fishing spots remained open.
John, just a quick follow-up comment. I think what you're hearing here is that we're going to be probably more persuaded, it's fair to say, by the biological monitoring data than the landings data, which, as you pointed out, are confounded by other factors, regulatory factors. But one of the things that has come up in the Marine Resources Committee, as you know, is an interest among stakeholders and among the commission in learning more about the interplay between the MLPA and the MLMA. And so I think you're part of an NC's working group on fisheries and marine protected areas that's chaired by a prominent fisheries biologist and co-chaired by an ecologist and a fisheries biologist. We would love to hear updates from you periodically on the progress of that.
I'm not part of that working group, but other department staff are, and I will certainly be happy to bring you some results of that as they come out.
Thank you, Commissioner Sutton. That's a good comment. I know we would like
to. And that would likely be appropriate to add to your December 2008 review, because by that time the NC's working group should be completed or have some results.
Thank you, John. Any further questions or comments? Thank you.
Thank you.
We have one public speaker on this, Paul Weakland.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland. We would like to start out with the old adage that figures lie and liars figure. How do you prevent the manufacturing or the misinterpreting of your data and information? Let's remember fear, false evidence appearing real. I believe that's what we have. We have a case of fear. We do not have any absolute numbers in any of this, but we do. But the fishing game continually neglects and purposely leaves out the number of fishermen. According to Ugritz over here, he says some of these trends we can't identify. Well, if he'd plug in the number of fishermen, maybe it would make it easier to understand. But he purposely leaves these numbers out. Let's talk about the white sea bass. You say it's a phenomenal fishery. Well, it was closed for how long and for when? What was the time that the white sea bass fishery was closed? There was no fishing allowed. Now you've opened it back up and voila, we have a winner. Yeah. But it should have never been closed in the first place, should it? These areas that are being talked about in the Channel Islands were areas of major scientific studies. And one of them was the outplanting of abalones, the abalone enhancement program, right in these areas that have been set aside for no fishing forevermore. Not a marine protected area, a no fishing zone. Now, what monitoring is being done on these outplant sites with the disease of withering syndrome and the cibellid worm that were purposely put out? But we don't want to talk about that. Fishing game wants to ignore all of these biological problems. Now, let's, for example, I have an analogy. Please, on this side, picture a bar chart. I don't have the fancy pinpoint, but you can imagine a bar chart here on this side, and you can imagine a graph chart on this side. Imagine this as your mirror, and the graph over here is a smoke. Do you know what happens when you flash the bar chart through the graph or the smoke through the mirrors? A pie chart forms on the wall. That's all you got here is a bunch of smoke and mirrors. And I think that some honesty and integrity would go far to eliminating these flawed concepts and unproven theories. And how do you prevent the grant-sucking parasites from squandering all of the monies that you are pouring into this? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Weakland. And for those of you who are watching on the web, we have the opportunity to enjoy Mr. Weakland at virtually every agenda item for the last, how many years has this gone on? It's been really quite a number of years. So, anyway, thank you, Mr. Weakland. You know what happens when you speak out like that. You've done it a number of times. Thank you. Next agenda item.
Brings us to item 15, receipt of public testimony on proposals to amend subsection B172.7 of section 7.50, Title 14, related to Saucel Creek sport fishing regulations. Please note that the adoption hearing is scheduled for December 17th, 2007, at a teleconference meeting of the commission. At this time, I don't believe the department has anything to add. This is receipt of public testimony, and we have received no speaker cards for public testimony this morning on this item. So,
any questions or comments from the commissioners?
No, I'd just like to thank the department staff for moving so expeditiously on this item. I know we took it out of cycle, and we needed to deal with these very few fish in this creek, and I really do appreciate.
Well said, Commissioner. Any further commentary? John?
Moves us to item 16A and B. 16A, final certification of environmental document and adoption of findings and proposed project or alternative for proposed changes to section 353 and 475, Title 14. This is related to methods authorized for taking big game and methods of take for non-game birds and non-game mammals. 16B, discussion and possible adoption of proposed changes to sections 353 and 475, Title 14, related to methods authorized for taking big game and methods of take for non-game birds and non-game mammals. Please note that we also include discussion of implementation of the recently signed AB 821. Dr. Eric Loft from the department, and I don't know where, did we step out?
Neil, are you going to take a look?
See hey, come on. Well, I thought Neil would come up and take care of it for us.
Yeah, I think not.
What?
Well, we have to find Eric, so.
He was there like a split second ago, so. Sankey?
What can you do? You know, you hire them, you try to train them.
The last branch chief would not have pulled a stunt like this. I was just telling Eric, the last branch chief for the wildlife branch wouldn't have pulled a stunt like this.
And just who was that, John?
Yeah. it's his fault. It's always Bill's fault. Dr. Loft, if you please.
I apologize. I thought there was another item before me.
There was.
And another one. Good morning, everyone. President Rogers, Commissioners, Eric Loft with the Wildlife Branch. And today we're here to item 16A, 16B, bring you our final environmental document as it relates to lead condors and sections 353 and 475. Handouts that you have is a copy of the environmental document, and the other handout is merely just the PowerPoint. We have several copies of the environmental document on the back for the public, and we intend to make those available if folks want to get a hold of them. Contact us, and we get them a copy of it for folks listening in.
Have we sent a copy of that over to Assemblyman Nava's office?
We have not yet, because this is just yeah,
hot as soon as you're ready, I think they would appreciate that.
Hot off the press. All right. First slide. You know, I'm entertained by the new technology where everyone but the speaker can see what's going on. Okay, I can see it a little bit here. What's the forward?
This is an eye test, Dr. Loft.
F button. All righty. Okay, so this first graphic, and what I thought we would do is for because of the NAVA bill and the passage of that and signing by the governor and establishment of Section 3004.5 in the Fish and Game Code now. I'm sure it's confusing to some folks that have been tracking this over the months, and what we thought we'd do is sort of to tee this up, remind everybody where we are and what are the options that the Commission still is going to be working on and deliberating on. So, first topic, 16A, final certification of the environmental document. We've revised the draft ED for final. We've incorporated the comments on the draft ED and completed it. There were 18 comment letters received on all the draft documents. That includes both versions. The earlier version that was issued in February and the second round, the recirculation that was issued in October, received 18 comment letters specifically on the document. Now, that does not include, of course, the hundreds of letters and thousands of emails that you might have received or the department might have received just recommending ban lead or don't ban lead. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about specific comments on the environmental document. The environmental document addresses the range of alternatives from no change all the way to a statewide prohibition of lead for big game and or non-game hunting. That was an F. There we go. Got it. All right. The requirements of Assembly Bill 821, Section 3004.5, I know it by heart now already, there are within the scope of the environmental document that was produced. So what that means is that the area and the restrictions that were proposed and adopted in statute now are a subset of the entire package that the department and commission was
was proposing. Is this for me?
No, apparently this no, this room is inhabited by ghosts, and those who believe in that, I suggest flee immediately.
That's okay.
The chief ghost producer.
We'll get the enforcement guys back on this one, perhaps. Commissioners and everyone, there are, as far as the department was concerned, no substantial environmental consequences or impacts of the regulatory actions that were proposed, evaluated, or anticipated that have been brought forward. And as a consequence of that, the department recommends the commission certify this final environmental document. Now, I have the next set of slides would go through a lot of what the options are and the alternatives, but that is could be 16B, and I'm not sure how you want to cover that all at once or in two parts.
Okay, let's do that on the certification first. Yeah, I think we're going to do this one by one.
Okay.
So I think we will, if it's the pleasure of the rest of the commission, we will do the certification issue first, and there is some public testimony on that. Before we muddy the waters here by going too much further.
Okay.
Very good.
Okay. That's the pleasure of the commission. John? Any questions right now of the commissioners of Dr. Loft? If not, we'll go to public comment on the certification.
A little technical glitch here. On folks' cards, many people did not differentiate whether they wanted to talk about 16A or 16B, and this will be 16A. So right now, if the few people that did differentiate, let me read them, that can come up and talk about 16A, and if you do wish to talk about 16A, this is strictly the environmental document. Go ahead and line up. But at this point, Ed Worley, Walt Mansell, and those are the only two that specifically said 16A, but if anyone else would turn in a card wants to. And 3 minutes apiece on this.
Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Ed Worley with the National Rifle Association. It's a pleasure to see you all again. And hopefully this will be one of the last meetings we have about the condor for some time. I've learned more about the California condor than I've ever thought I'd ever know. It's a very fascinating animal, and I hope that all of us can help keep the animal in the wild and help preserve the animal. It's a very magnificent animal in the wild. This has been a very long, drawn-out process, and I think a lot of us have learned a lot of interesting things about the legislative process and the legislation that was passed. But something you need to consider in the regulations and the environmental draft document is that we in the NRA oppose any expansion of the regulations beyond the scope of AB 821, as was passed by the legislature. The NRA urges the Fish and Game Commission to continue to encourage scientific analysis and peer review of the threats of the condor and the consequences, intended or otherwise, of the implementation of AB 821. We think you need to have ongoing meetings every year or so, or even other time as the scientific information comes up, because what we're going to see now is a real-world study of what really is going to happen now. Because of this non-lead ammunition, however that is defined, is going to be used in the game habitat, now we're going to really get to see where the real lead contamination is coming from. So just to do this and now move on, the process isn't over. This is only the beginning of a process, in our opinion. What you're going to see now is what's actually going to happen in the wildlife, what's going to happen actually to the game. So I would encourage the Fish and Game Commission to, on an ongoing basis, come back and review the scientific information and look at it. But also you need to look at some problems in the proposals here. One of the proposals talks about including black powder firearms and including the projectiles in that. The question I have for you is, if a hunter is out hunting with a black powder firearm and they have the firearm loaded, how are you going to check the projectile to see if it's non-lead, if it's already loaded in the firearm? That's going to be a little bit of a problem to check the projectile on the firearm after it's already been loaded for shooting. In paragraph F2 on the purported proposals, what does the commission intend to define as a violation of the simple possession of traditional ammunition and firearms while hunting? The commission, the proposals here, make it a very broad determination. They say, if you're in the field and you're hunting or in the act of hunting, and you're in the simple possession of traditional ammunition and a firearm that can fire that, it's a violation of the law. So if a hunter is out hunting and they've left their vehicle, they're by their vehicle, and the warden comes out and finds a traditional ammunition anywhere in the vehicle or anywhere on their possession, in their backpack or anything else, either inadvertently or any other way, they technically would be in violation of the law.
You need to summarize.
Yes, sir, I will. One last thing. What is going to be the process for the certification of non-lead ammunition? What is going to be the public process of the certification? To be used in compliance with AB 21. When will the list of certified non-lead ammunition be finalized and published for public review and consideration? Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Moreland.
Walt Manziel.
Good morning, President Rogers, members of the commission, Walt Manziel representing the California Rifle and Pistol Association. With respect to the document itself and the comments in there, I have very little to offer. I believe that there's been inadequate study of the potential loss in hunting, especially since the NAVA bill encompasses several very active deer zones in areas where condors have not existed for several decades. I think you will have some effect there. In addition to the traditional present range of the condor. And the second thing is that I'm concerned that you haven't totally studied the science of the whole problem. It's, you know, there needs to be a lot more done here, much broader than the science on lead bullets and condors. There's a lot of problems that the condors have that are preventing their reintroduction to the wild that probably your commission can't address, but they have to be recognized that they're, the ultimate demise of the condor probably does not depend on this issue at all. Thank you.
Thank you. Well,
at this point, if there's no other folks that would like to speak specifically on the environmental document, we staff has a suggested motion.
Go ahead.
The Fish and Game Commission hereby certifies that the final environmental document on methods authorized for taking big game and methods of take for non-game birds and non-game mammals has been completed in compliance with the California Environmental Quality Act, and that it was presented to the Commission and that the Commission has reviewed and considered the information contained in the final environmental document prior to approving the project. The certified environmental document provides that there are no significant adverse environmental impacts resulting from the proposed project. The Commission finds on the basis of the facts in the record and the environmental document that the proposed project and alternatives will have no significant adverse impact.
Do I hear that motion?
So moved.
Do I hear a second?
Second.
Is there any discussion from any of the commissioners? Do we need a roll call or do we need just a voice vote? Voice vote?
Mm-hmm. Voice vote.
Voice vote. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Unanimous? Continue.
So item 16B, discussion and possible adoption of proposed changes to sections 353 and 475, Title 14, methods authorized for taking big game and methods of take for non-game birds and non-game mammals. Dr. Eric Loft.
Commissioners, Eric Loft again, Wildlife Branch. Okay. And I'll continue on. Item 16B, proposed changes and the options that are before you that are open for regulatory consideration. In a summary of this and what we're trying to do and have tried to do between the department staff, commission staff, and the legal counsel of both is try to decipher and wade through all this and figure out what are the options that are still out there for the commission to decide on. And these are, in, that we've come up with, are establish the geographic area. There are still options there. The area defined by NAVA is the minimum area. A projectile definition, maximum lead threshold in bullets or projectiles, if you do define projectiles. The capability or option to consider an exemption for obsolete custom or Wildcat cartridges. Some of our folks thought when we called it Wildcat that we were actually talking about an animal, so we said, well, let's change that maybe. So that's kind of why we have Wildcat now in parentheses on this slide. The consideration of a possible exemption for the use of 22 caliber or smaller rimfire, and possessing lead projectiles while hunting is another consideration, and also the implementation dates that would take effect with these regulations. Establishing the geographic area, what we have, of course, with the NAVA bill is a composite, really, of what our initial proposed was and what option, our second option was. So it really, it fits in within the framework, and it's a combination of two is what the NAVA bill is. Section 3004.5, the NAVA bill, if you were to select that one in the process of the regulatory actions, that would be a no change option, and that would be implementing the NAVA bill geographic area specifically. The other option before you is what we had called option 3B or 7B, depending on whether you're looking at 353 or 475. And that establishes the NAVA area, plus it also includes the rest of the South A zone unit, deer zone. And what that is based on is from a mechanics and implementation perspective, For the department, it was easier just to identify deer zones in that option that we put forward. But that's not what's in the NAVA bill. And because of this, our recommendation from the department is for geographic area for both 353 and 475 is a no-change option to the geographic area.
Does the commission want to discuss these, each one of them individually, or should we wait? What's the commission's pleasure? Do you want to wait until we go through all of the options?
I would recommend that we let him give his presentation, have public testimony, and then we'll start dissecting each issue.
Good.
Okay.
Good idea. Everybody feel? Yes. No, we'll do it that way. Please go ahead, Eric.
Sure. The next option is looking or defining a projectile definition. A no-change option there would leave us without a definition of the various, quote, bullets that fall under the no-lead designation. The proposed option was a projectile is defined as any bullet, ball, sabot, slug, buckshot, or other device which is expelled from a firearm through a barrel by the force of any explosion. And apologies to Mr. Manziel, who's told me in the past that it's not an explosion. Can you clarify for me what it is?
It's a rapid burning.
Combustion,
right.
Thank you. Defining projectiles as proposed would bring all big game hunting methods into conformance with Section 3004.5, and that includes or excludes archery, and so that means it would include muzzle loaders as well. And the department recommends the proposed definition for both 353 and 475. To the commission. The next option before you is defining a maximum lead threshold in a bullet or a projectile. A no-change option there, if you select that, would leave us without designating a maximum trace level of lead that could be contained in a non-lead ammunition or projectile. The proposed option would be that no lead or non-lead projectiles would be defined as containing trace levels of lead comprising less than 1% of the projectile weight. In defining a level of lead allowable enables hunting to occur as the understanding is there are trace levels of lead in a non-lead projectiles as a consequence of the manufacturing process. And because of that, the department recommends that the commission establish that proposed language of a minimum threshold less than 1%. The next option before you is consideration of exempting obsolete or custom cartridges. No change in that category would require that these custom loads and their projectiles be non-lead consistent with the NAVA bill, section 3004.5. If you were to exempt the cartridges, that would be contrary to the NAVA bill. And because of that, the department recommends the no change option for 353 and 475, subjecting those custom cartridges, Wildcats, to the same regulation as the center fire projectiles. Now, the exemption for the use of 22 caliber or smaller rimfire options. This is only applies to 475 non-game, as 22 caliber rimfire is not a legal method to take for big game. The no change option on this one would exempt 22 rimfire and smaller cartridges and continue to allow non-game species other than coyote to be killed with lead projectiles. Coyotes, by our interpretation of this of the bill, cannot now be killed with a 22 caliber or smaller or rimfire cartridge. Another option before you would be to prohibit lead projectiles for hunting non-game, except the coyote, with 22 caliber and smaller rimfire. And our interpretation of this is that it effectively eliminates the use of 22 caliber throughout the area for shooting non-game animals until a no-lead projectile is made available. And then in discussing this with commission staff over the past couple of weeks, we've put in here what we consider maybe another option that's before you, is consider exempting 22 rimfire and smaller from the lead restriction, but require disposal of killed non-game so that they are unavailable to scavengers. Commissioners, our interpretation on this particular topic is that there is no real perfect solution that we see in this one, so we believe that it needs some dialogue amongst you and the public. The next option is possessing lead projectiles while hunting. And the options are no change. It leaves hunters in the field with the potential to have a lead projectile in their possession. The proposed language the proposed option is that the hunter, when I'm saying proposed, I mean what was proposed in the environmental document as well as in the ISOR. Hunter may not possess a lead projectile and firearm capable of shooting it while attempting to take big game or non-game in the 3004.5 area. The NAVA bill area. And the department recommends the proposed language for both 353 and 475. And this would subject muzzleloader hunters to the same regulation as center fire as well. So that item, too, is one that may be at issue in terms of enforcement capability and things like that. Next item is the implementation date. The NAVA bill has an effective date not later than July 1 of 2008. Regulations that the commission may adopt, you might be able to set your own timetable for some of the regulations that you would implement. And the recommendation from us is because of how we throw out the booklets and the timing, that it best be that all regulations that are going to change be consistent and happen at the same time, if at all possible. So that's our recommendation from the department.
Thank you, Eric.
Final and additional. Oops, I got one more. The last additional considerations. It was mentioned the certification program. Over the next few months, the department and commission staff will be coordinating on developing the non-lead ammunition certification program and working on that topic. The other item that's in the NAVA bill related to funding for a coupon program, and as of yet, no funding has been identified for a coupon program. The question came to us before, how many hunters do we think are affected? We estimate that at least 35,000 big game hunters would be affected within the NAVA bill area. The non-game hunters, largely unknown how many that is. Another item is that the department and other entities, particularly through the condo recovery team, they're working to prioritize and plan monitoring to the extent possible in advance of the law change taking effect. And also, commissioners, and in particular President Rogers, we'd heard that you were interested in pursuing some of the science related to this whole topic. We have embarked on a research agreement with the UC Davis Wildlife Health Center to begin to do just that, to look at lead and its impact on not just condors but other raptor species throughout the state of California. And that's a process that's underway, project that's underway with the UC Davis. Thank you. That's all I have.
Thank you, Dr. Law. We have the commission will now take a five-minute break, and then we'll have public commentary. Sonke and Bill, are you set, or can we? Okay, we'll go to public commentary then. John?
Our first speaker is Dr. Robert Riseborough from the Condor Recovery Team, and he actually has a approximately 10-minute presentation on an update for the commission on some of the latest science from the recovery team as related to this issue.
President Rogers, Vice President Gustafson, Mr. Kellogg, Mr. Sutton, good morning. My name is Robert Riseborough, and I'm here on behalf of the California Condor Recovery Team. Normally, we're meant to say that we serve at the pleasure of the Director of the Department of the Interior, that we don't get involved in any kind of politics, particularly politics that would in any way embarrass any part of the Department of the Interior, and that we don't give advice to anybody else but the Fish and Wildlife Service, except, of course, in cases like this when we have been invited to provide some recommendations, and it's a pleasure to respond to this request. The purpose is to establish criteria for the maximum amounts of lead in a projectile, a bullet, or a shot, that would not harm a condor if it should feed on the carcass of an animal that has been killed using such a projectile or projectiles. Now, this is not an easy job. There are many variables to consider. For example, a condor may ingest a fragment of a bullet and then the lead slowly starts to dissolve. Now, the rate at which it dissolves is very important. If it's sufficiently slow, the lead will accumulate in bones or be excreted and never reach the point at which it would be harmful to a condor. But if it dissolves more rapidly, it could well harm or even kill the condor. So we have to take that into account. Lead in a collection of small particles will erode at a much faster rate than lead in a few big particles. So we need to consider what size of particle the condors might ingest. And then we have to consider behavior of metals. When lead is mixed with iron, theoretically, it will not dissolve at all until all of the lead has dissolved. It's something to do with anodes. And conversely, if mixed with copper, the lead will dissolve faster than the copper. We've got to take that into account. So we've prepared a technical report, which is not easy reading. There are enough numbers in there to drive anyone crazy and to make anyone confused, including myself if I go back a day or two later, but the intent is that that would provide a technical basis for review by people who know about such things, a basis for discussion, and for revisions if necessary. Now, the criteria that we did reach were in bullets, and the assumption was that they'd be copper bullets, no more than 10 parts per million of lead, and in shot, no more than 0.1% of lead. Now, this is not the forum to discuss all the technical reasons why. I think the next step would be to communicate with Fish and Game on the reasons why these are proposed, and then to go back and forth with Fish and Game and anybody else who is interested to see if we can come up with a consensus, or at least to lay out all of the rationale so that you can make an intelligent decision. Now, I take the opportunity to point out that Section 3004.5D, which was added to the Fish and Game Code by AB 821, reads, "The Commission shall issue a report on the levels of lead found in California condors. This report shall cover calendar years 2008, 2009, and 2012. Each report shall be issued by you by June of the following year." With several colleagues and with the support of a private foundation, I have been putting together all of the available lead data, which will go into one database that will be accessible to anyone. So this could then form the baseline for the detection of any changes that might result from the substitution of lead ammunition. Now, currently, the lead monitoring program is a collaborative effort by Fish and Wildlife Service in Ventura, by the Ventana Wildlife Society, and by the Pinnacles National Monument. The Scientific Advisory Committee of the recovery team is currently making recommendations or formulating recommendations on how the monitoring program might specifically address this specific need. And that will finish that in the very near future. And then it's our intent also in early January to consult with Mr. Carlson and tell him where we are so that we might discuss how the present monitoring program could assist you in your task of producing these reports. So thank you very much. Once again, a pleasure to be here.
Thank you, Dr. Osborough. I might point out that the last six letters of your name are my middle name, but it's pronounced entirely differently.
Well, may I ask how you're pronounced?
No. Bruff, in my case. Thank you.
And we have several other speakers on this issue. I'll call three names at a time, and please line up as the previous speaker is wrapping up, and we'll have 3 minutes per person. Jim Peterson, followed by Pamela Flick, followed by Noel Kremers. Jim Peterson, I guess.
Peterson.
P-E-T-T-E-R.
Yep, it's a Swedish name. Also in there should be a card for Eric Bruneman. Would it be possible to have us go back-to-back because we have information or testimony that's...
Yes, sure. Who is the other person?
Eric Bruneman.
Okay.
And could he precede me?
Precede you.
Yeah.
He's my
next
boss.
Next time, write that on the card. Go ahead.
Is he...
You used most of his time, though, but yeah, go ahead.
It's sort of the story of my life.
Yeah, really.
It's Bruneman. It's not Swedish. Good morning, President Rogers, Vice President Gustafson, Commission members. My name's Eric Bruneman. I'm the superintendent of Pinnacles National Monument. I have a few brief prepared comments. The National Park Service maintains its support for proposed changes to Sections 353 and 475, Title 14, which includes establishing a geographic area in which non-lead projectiles would be required for big game and non-game hunting. In further consideration, I'd like to address depredation permits, if you will. From my own firsthand experience and that of our NPS biologists like Jim Peterson, I would say condors are opportunistic scavengers. They feed on large as well as small mammals, including wild pigs, and even we have documentation for ground squirrels. Our best example was documented on June 25th of this year when California condors fed on a wild pig carcass that was shot with a 22 caliber rimfire. Chief Biologist Peterson will give you a little more information on that in just a minute. I'd further say that within the Gabilan Range, dead wild pigs are a frequently documented and observed wild food source for the California condors where we are. Based on these observations, I'd urge the Commission to extend the use of non-lead ammunition to depredation permits, especially depredation of wild pigs, which are a documented source of lead exposure to our condors within the Gabilan Range. Moving along, I would also urge the Commission to explore a measure to reduce the risk of lead poisoning by 22 caliber rimfire or smaller lead ammunition. As a corollary to that thought, regarding any wording for a 22 caliber rimfire exemption, if an exemption is considered, I'd ask the Commission to include language that would allow for a reevaluation or reexamination of non-lead alternatives for 22s or smaller when they become available in the future. Thank you. Those are my prepared comments. I would is my time up?
No. apparently, the wardens
Chief
are
Foley.
Trying to alter,
Chief Foley, can
alter
you get a hold
the
of
act
your wardens?
A little here.
I'd like to personally thank the commission for
you notice where
time.
Chief Foley, by the way, where yes. where she is standing, uh-huh. she's not having anything to do with those switches.
That's just,
just hope they don't lean on their sidearm next.
Yeah, let's
I got the
true.
Message, Chief. Thank you.
Don't worry about your time, please.
Okay. I would just personally like to thank the commission. I know this has been a long process, but the process is important, and thank you for all the views that have been presented. I put my comments on letterhead, and I'll pass them over right now.
Thank you, Mr. Brenneman. Mr. Peterson.
And thank you for tolerating our little humor here.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Again, good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to elaborate a little bit more. Hopefully there's a PowerPoint that's going to be visible here.
Please state your name for the record. I forgot to mention all speakers should state their name at the beginning of their talk for the record.
And who they represent.
Sure. My name is Jim Pedersen. I'm the supervisory wildlife biologist at Pinnacles National Monument, and I oversee the condor recovery program there. As you probably know, the Central California population exists at Pinnacles National Monument and 35 miles to the west at Ventana Wildlife Society. And the arrow demonstrates that they move back and forth quite a bit. In fact, the flocks are becoming very closely intermixed. And for the most part, they feed on the food that's put out for them, which are primarily calves from organic dairy farms. And it's hard to get an exact count, but probably the majority of the time they are feeding on those calves. But when they come over to Pinnacles, they have access to a food source that we believe, based on our observations, is largely wild pigs. And just by the nature of how many wild pigs there are around Pinnacles, we believe it constitutes the greatest wild food source. Some ranches have the need to control wild pig populations to the tune of 400 pigs a year on a ranch, and we recognize that and see that need. The damage they can do is very significant. The particular incident that Eric talked about, that Dr. John Smith brought up in August, had to do with a particular pig that was shot with a 22 caliber rimfire. The condors had found that, and in looking at the pig with X-ray, we found that there were two bullets in it. We retrieved the bullets from the pigs, And in comparison with other 22 rim fires, we feel confident that those were the cause of the subsequent blood lead levels that went up when we captured the condor. And you've all seen this chart or this graph. I won't go into it, but the on the right-hand side there, the signature of those bullets matched the other ammunition lead isotope signatures and matched the increases in the condors. So as it currently exists, the amount of wild pigs that could be shot, according to depredation activities, far exceeds those that would fall under the AB 821, big game hunting. So to reiterate, we would just ask the commission to extend the mandatory use of non-lead centerfire ammunition to include depredation permits for wild pigs. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you. Commissioners, I just would like to, excuse me.
Thank you for sharing that.
I want to point out that the depredation statutes are actually set by the legislature. So at this point, what's in front of you today does not affect depredation. The department has already on its own set into policy that when it writes a depredation tag in condor territory, that it is under the conditions of the permit request or requiring that the party use non-lead. But unfortunately, at this point, it's in statute, and the commission does not have the regulatory authority over that.
Well, perhaps someone can approach Senator Nava, who appears to be rather good at this, Senator Assemblyman Nava, and do a rider. Another bill. We'll see.
I'm on it.
Continuing with the speakers, Pamela Flick, followed by Noel Kremers, followed by Kelly Sorensen.
Good morning, Commissioners. Pamela Flick with Defenders of Wildlife, and on behalf of our 1 million members nationwide and 200,000 members here in California, I'd like to thank you for your continued deliberation on this important topic. We urge you to adopt all of the department's proposed changes and regulations as Dr. Loft presented this morning, with the exception of the geographic range. In speaking with some of the department's staff, it's my understanding that choosing the option 3B and 7B would ease in enforcement by being inclusive of the entire hunting zone South A. So we encourage you to adopt 3B and 7B for the geographic range. I'd also like to echo the recommendation on the depredation permits, and now I have a new chapter to begin, I guess, at the legislature on that front. And also encourage the commission to look into the monitoring data that will come in the future after these regulations are implemented, and consider statewide regulations to ban lead if that data suggests that would be prudent. So thank you again.
Thank you, Pamela. Either you have chocolate in your mouth or you're away from the microphone.
I was just working on a little technical glitch here. Noel Kremers, followed by Kelly Sorensen, followed by Dick Dasman.
Good morning. Noel Kremers with California Farm Bureau. Mr. President, Commissioners, thank you very much for the opportunity to comment. Briefly, I have 3 points. Our members, I'm here representing our livestock producer members who have to face the predators that are preying on calves, sheep, and lambs, and goats. And we want to make sure that when ammunition, non-lead ammunition is required, that it's workable for our members. First of all, we would support option A that limits the ammunition limit to the range of the condor. If there are risks shown to the condor, we think that that's where the restriction should be rather than statewide or throughout all the deer zones. Second, we absolutely support the free or reduced cost ammunition and would hope that funding's available for that, and would hope that we can figure out a way not only to provide that to hunters but also to our members. And we would offer up the Farm Bureau and the county farm bureaus as a way to interface with our members trying to access that. Third, we would recommend that you work closely with USDA Wildlife Services. They are often the ones providing the support for predation services, to go after the predators, and so they're the ones most likely on the ground doing depredation, and so we would recommend that you work closely with them. I would like to second Mr. Carlson's comments. We suspected that the department, when they're issuing depredation permits, would follow the non-lead ammunition ban, and we support that within the Condor range. We just want to make sure that it's workable for our members. Thank you.
Thank you.
Kelly Sorensen, followed by Dick Dasman, followed by Jeff Miller.
Thank you, Commissioners. I'll be very brief because pretty much everyone that came before me has said what I wanted to say, except I just wanted to thank all of you for all of your efforts on this. This is something that I've personally been working on, and it's involved me for 10 years now, and I forgot to state my name. I apologize. Yes. So Kelly Sorensen.
And who you represent.
With Ventana Wildlife Society.
Thank you.
Where we've been releasing condors in Central California for 10 years. And so this has been an incredibly important issue to us, and so I just want to once again thank you for all your efforts. I support all of the recommendations from the department and might even suggest that you consider at some point in the future broadening the boundary, the geographic boundary, to include all of the hunt zones where the condor range is. It might be easier to enforce. The hunt zones are easier to follow than, you know, what does the NAVA bill say, Highway 99 and west of 5 and all that kind of stuff. So it might just be easier to go with the full hunt zones. But I understand it might be also important to sort of roll that out because of the number of hunters affected. And now I have more clarity on the pig depredation permit, so thank you. And please adopt the regulations today if possible. Thank you.
Mr. Sorensen.
Dick Dasman, followed by Jeff Miller, followed by Susan LeGrand.
Dick Dasman, Royal Grande Sportsman. I'd like to set the record straight, if I might, on some comments from yesterday. I think the hunters and sportsmen got a bad beef yesterday in some presentation. I submit to you that the vast majority of hunters are responsible and promote what we can do to save the condor and the rest of the ecology. I think we are in the forefront of the environmental work, and I think we've proved that, especially down in the Central Coast area. It's too bad that the NAVA bill included the wildcat rounds. That's going to significantly impact the traditional type hunter that's using grandfather's old rifle, etc., and as well that it included the coyotes, which I do not believe there's been any scientific evidence to prove that a condor or any other bird has ever fed on a coyote. And I think if you talk to experts in the field, they'll tell you the same thing. That's why the ranchers leave them where they leave them on the fence, and they disintegrate before they're eaten. But unfortunately, we can't change that. I would recommend that you adopt the minimum area of the condor range until such time as future reports indicate that this is, in fact, the problem with the condors. I think this is a contributing factor. I've worked to educate the hunters in our area of that. I do not think it's the solution to the problem. And I think we're going to have a tremendous enforcement problem in some of these areas, particularly with muzzle loaders. In order to examine what's in the rifle, you're going to destroy the round and the powder in order to pull it. I think we need to get on the same page with enforcement. And in our area, I've tried to work with the enforcement branch to better get to know them and understand what their criteria are going to be in the field. And I think that's important for the hunters and the enforcement people to recognize that we're all out here together, we're all out here to do the same thing, and we're not adversaries. I think the people that are adversaries are the ones the enforcement branch needs to go get. So I think we have to get together on some of the criteria for examining the rounds, et cetera. And as I pointed out in the past, some of the non-lead rounds are identical to the lead rounds. You cannot tell them apart, and that's going to be an enforcement issue as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Dasman.
Jeff Miller, followed by Susan LeGrand, followed by James Berkland.
Good morning, Commissioners. Jeff Miller with the Center for Biological Diversity. And I also want to thank you for your patience and attention over the past few years of this issue. I think it's great that California is taking the lead in getting lead out of the food chain. It's important to note that AB 821 is a very significant step in removing what we think is the major sources of lead that's poisoning condors, but that this is not going to end the availability of lead that condors can encounter, and it may not end lead poisons, and we need to be very careful about drawing conclusions about what happens over the next few years. And you've heard testimony about how depredation hunting, also upland bird hunting, non-game mammals, and fur-bearing mammal hunting are potential avenues for condors to continue to encounter lead within the Navajo area. So just to bear that in mind as we try to determine what effect this is having over the next few years. We generally urge you to adopt the regulations that the department is suggesting, with a few exceptions. Our petition to this commission 3 years ago was primarily focused on condors, but we also did ask you to act to protect other wildlife species and human health, and this is an issue beyond just the condor range. There is evidence that bald eagles, golden eagles, and other birds of prey are being poisoned and being killed by lead from ammunition, and there is still the human health issue in other geographic areas besides the AB 821 area. In terms of enforcement, we also agree that if you are looking at just the Navajo area, it makes sense to expand it to the entire hunt zone for enforcement. Want to just mention that we do support and encourage a hunter rebate program, and we would ask the commission to also look at some kind of phase-in for .22 caliber and other ammunition that could be correlated with availability of ammunition. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Brown.
Susan LeGrand, followed by James Berkland, followed by Walt Manziel.
Good morning. I'm Susan LeGrand with the California Cattlemen's Association. The California Cattlemen's Association represents beef cattle producers throughout the state of California, and I will be brief as many of my comments are already stated. As far as the establishment of the geographic area, we would urge the commission to select the option that limits the area to the known condor range. Additionally, we would also urge the commission to explore opportunities for expanding the funding opportunities to offset costs for our livestock producers that use ammunition and predator control. And lastly, we would like to support the exemption for the .22 caliber and smaller ammunition. Much of that is used in the control of predators and animals that are doing damage to property. And again, we'd like to thank you for the opportunity to provide comments.
Thank you.
James Berkland, followed by Walt Manziel, followed by Ed Worley.
Good morning, Commissioners. My name is James Berkland. I'm here on behalf of the Natural Resources Defense Council. I'd like to start by thanking the commission for turning their attention to the threat of lead ammunition to condors. However, NRDC continues to have concerns with the limited measures being considered. The Navajo bill and proposals to regulate lead ammunition hunting for big game, non-game mammals, and non-game birds are critical first steps. But what about the hunting with lead of small mammals and birds? Entire categories of species, as defined under commission regulations, remain unaddressed, including resident small game, upland game birds, and fur-bearing mammals. This is a big problem. Condors are highly opportunistic scavengers. Over 55,000 tree squirrels, cotton rabbits, and jackrabbits are shot in condor habitat annually. Add to that several thousand fur-bearing mammals, including raccoon and gray fox, as well as numerous upland birds. According to the department's own 2003 report on condors and lead, scientists have directly observed condors feeding on jackrabbits, which are classified as resident small game, as well as small non-game mammals such as ground squirrels, skunks, kangaroo rats, and weasels. There is also a record of bird feathers being found in a condor nest, and there's every reason to believe that condors forage on a wide array of other small mammals and birds. The Commission's legal obligations under the Federal Endangered Species Act and otherwise require a comprehensive solution to address the hunting of all species with lead and end all lead poisoning to condors. Briefly, NRDC also urges the Commission to proactively address the use of .22 rimfire lead ammunition. There are special challenges here because currently no non-lead alternatives exist to .22 caliber lead ammunition rimfire. But an aggressive schedule for phasing out this ammunition is needed to protect condors. Thank you.
Thank you.
Walt Manziel, followed by Ed Worley, followed by Bill Gaines.
Walt?
Paul Mansell, representing the California Rifle and Pistol Association. I'm going to pass out, if it's with your permission, Mr. President. These are bullets. They are not loaded ammunition. They are strictly inert projectiles, and I'll bring a handful up there for Sherry to see that each of you get one, if you would, please. This projectile you're receiving is the new Nosler E bullet, a bullet that is also non-lead. Begging the good doctor's pardon that testified first, they also contained a considerable quantity of zinc, so non-lead bullets are not necessarily all copper. You have a spec sheet coming around which shows you the maximum allowable trace elements of several different elements, including lead, that the manufacturer allows in the raw materials they receive from the foundries to make these bullets from. And they're well within the 1% number that was suggested by the department, and we think that's a very good place to start. California Rifle and Pistol Association urges you to let the Nava bill stand as it was passed. Leave the area the same. Leave the species addressed the same, and leave the firearms allowed and talked about the same. Do not extend any of this to other species, other firearms, or other geographical areas. It covers well over the range of the current condor. If you draw the new lines on a map, several have said it's easier to work on deer zones. It's a very simple boundary. It can be drawn on a map quite simply the way the Nava bill states it. I have that on the department's deer zone map if anybody wants to see that. We urge you to certify the Barnes solid copper bullets and the Nosler E non-lead bullet, which you have before you, as being non-lead bullets. We urge you not to attempt in any way, shape, or form to differentiate between factory ammunition and hand-loaded ammunition. Hand-loaded ammunition, which would cover all the wildcats that people have talked about, meets the criteria of the law if the person reloads it with a projectile which is non-lead. We are working with Chief Foley to develop some training for wardens in recognition. The bullet you have before you, by the way, is a kind of a new wrinkle because of the OD-colored tip. It is recognizable And this is the only non-lead bullet Nosler produces at this time, but if they produce more in any diameter or any cartridge or caliber, it will still have this colored tip to it, so it will be recognizable in the field.
You need to summarize, Walt.
Yeah. In summary, we feel the EIR is not adequate if you extend what you're doing, because we feel the EIR has been superseded in many important areas by the NAVA bill, and there are still some other discrepancies there. So we urge you to do what you need to do according to AB 821 to adopt it and to let that stand until we see how that works for several years down the road. It should be more than adequate to give us a good idea if this is going to have any positive effect.
Thank you.
Questions?
No question. Thank you all. Nope. Oh, there is. Sir.
Just a quick clarification question. I guess it's as much for Dr. Riseborough as for you. If my math is correct, which is a significant assumption, Dr. Riseborough has recommended, the condo recovery team is recommending 10 parts per million lead as the standard for bullets. That's 0.001%. Nosler says its bullets are held to a standard of 0.01% lead, which is 10 times as much lead as recommended by the recovery team. I don't know what, you know, how this affects the standard that we adopt, but these are pretty low standards, and it just seems like there's a disconnect there.
I don't believe any manufacturer of current readily acceptable lead bullets will guarantee you that lower level that he stressed. And I'm kind of bewildered on how they drew the parallel that something that weighs one-tenth of one-tenth of one grain in a 180-grain bullet is going to kill the condor.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm asking, I guess. Yeah. The standard that Nosler has here is 100 parts per million versus 10 parts per million.
Correct.
Recommended by the condor recovery team. So,
and these are standards that the Nosler people tell me that's the best they can get guaranteed by the people that make the alloys that are delivered to them.
Ed Worley.
Actually, oh, you know, when come to think of it, if you were to look at Nosler's analysis, even their silver content is higher than what the condor recovery team recommends, and I don't think Nosler's selling jewelry. Sankey?
I just wanted to make a quick comment on this issue of content versus exposure to lead toxicity. You know, obviously the condor recovery team's looking at what amount of lead do they believe the condors can tolerate. There's a big difference between that, in other words, blood content exposure versus a trace element composition, whether that's even available to be digested by the intestinal system of a condor. We don't know that. Our percentage recommendation is based solely on the metallurgical trace exposure. We have no idea whether that trace is even available to be digested. I don't know how it's molecularly bonded or anything like that. So I don't think you can relate the two. They're not equatable. And that's something I think research would have to look into is question is a trace amount in a copper bullet even expose a condor to really any lead biologically? That I don't
exactly
think.
Because it's in a complex molecule,
right? And I don't know that
free associated lead that's in a particle.
Our goal,
it's a very different thing.
Our goal with the percent, just to be clear, is strictly to not have any lead metal as a major component of the
right.
bullets. No raw lead metal that would be available to condor. That's the target there.
Understand.
Ed Worley, followed by Bill Gaines.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, Ed Worley with the National Rifle Association again. What your discussion just had is part of the conundrum you're facing. The NAVA bill is fairly specific. NAVA bill does not say partial non-lead bullets. The NAVA bill says non-lead ammunition. The NAVA bill does not say non-lead projectiles. The NAVA bill says non-lead ammunition. The California Penal Code specifies in the Penal Code between projectiles and ammunition. ammunition is not projectiles. Part of your discussion you're having, you're discussing projectiles, you're discussing bullets. In the California Penal Code, ammunition is specified as a different category within Penal Code. So in the definition of the Nava bill, they're talking about not projectiles. They're talking about ammunition. In the certification process that you are going to have to create, part of the discussion you're having right now is part of the problem you're going to have, is how, as a manufacturer, going to certify through you that the ammunition is non-lead. Before the Nava bill was passed, we all remember, in all the meetings we've all been to here, that you discussed the definition of non-toxic. And that's the definition you're going to try to use. That is now irrelevant, because now we're not talking about non-toxic ammunition. We're talking about a specific language in the Nava bill that says non-lead ammunition. So that is part of the problem you're going to have. The best thing I would recommend, and we in the NRA recommend, is you keep to what the Nava bill declares in the statute, and you narrowly pass it there, because I guarantee you, all of us who are talking about not having to come to any more of these meetings and discuss this issue are sorely mistaken. This issue is far from being over, far from being solved, because now you're having people who said, oh, we're talking about non-lead bullets. Now the discussion is not about non-lead bullets. Now the discussion is how much lead is going to be allowed in the bullets. Now that's where the conundrum is going to get into. Now you have two different divergent opinions, this opinion, that opinion. The problem is now we're all on a timeline here. This is not a debatable timeline. The clock is ticking as we talk today. The certification process needs to happen. Because now, if none of these issues are resolved, and remember, the Nava bill requires you to certify to public and have a certification process in the public to certify non-lead ammunition. It's not anybody's opinion. It's not anybody's hope. It's not anybody's dreams. It's what the Department of Fish and Game certifies and creates a certification process to be. So that is where all we're going to be. The thing you really need to consider also is how in the field are you going to have a warden determine if the person in the field is carrying non-lead ammunition? That is a major problem you're going to have. And we have people all the time who run afoul of the California Penal Code for minor violations. You're talking about opening up a huge Pandora's box in the field for hunters who happen to inadvertently carry traditional cartridges with them in the field. In the way the regulations are specified now, if I'm out in the field and I happen to have one rifle cartridge on me, that's a traditional cartridge, I neglected and left it in my shooting vest or on my person, and I am confronted by a game warden and they do an inspection of me, I am in violation of the law if I have a traditional cartridge on my person. There's no variation in your regulations you've proposed. And that is a problem, because the intent has always been, is that person have the intent to use that cartridge for hunting, or do they happen to inadvertently have it on their possession?
Need to wrap it up.
Yes, sir. So I guarantee you we're all going to be seeing each other again on an ongoing basis, because the discussion is far from over. I thank you very much for taking the time and consideration of everything you've done. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I am moved to comment that it's very important for people to understand that for the last 20 years, and the next speaker can attest to this, in waterfowl hunting, you are arrested if you have a lead shell in your cart in your possession. There's no difference. We've been doing this for 20 years, but then again, the NRA represents gun owners, not hunters. Next speaker, please.
Bill Gaines is our final speaker card for this issue today.
President Rogers, members of the commission, department staff, my name is Bill Gaines, and I'm president of the California Outdoor Heritage Alliance. I'll try to be brief. I will not reiterate my comments that I made to the commission in early November, but I would like to make a few points. One is certainly worth mentioning again, and that is we strongly urge the commission to not expand the regulations that were called out by AB 821 in regards to species and boundary of the lead ban above and beyond what AB 821 calls out. There's absolutely no scientific rationale that calls for a ban in any range greater than the Condor range called out in the legislation. Secondly, we do urge the commission to adopt a regulation which does allow the 1% trace elements of lead in the bullets so that hunting can continue with the current non-toxic loads that are available today. Thirdly, we do urge the commission to exempt 22 and smaller calibers as well as muzzle loaders from the regulation. We also urge the commission to adopt possession regulations which are reasonable and do not put undue burden on the hunters and do not end up with law-abiding, well-intended hunters ending up getting cited for something that that they did not intend to do. And lastly, we do urge the commission to strongly urge the Department of Fish and Game and other scientific, legitimate scientific entities that are out there to vigorously monitor and evaluate lead levels in condors so that we can have better science in regards to the true impact of lead bullets upon blood lead levels in the condors. And lastly, we also support the comments of Walt Manzel and the California Rifle and Pistol Association in regards to reloading. And we do urge, finally, that the commission move swiftly on this so that we can see a seamless and hopefully painless transition into the 2008 hunting season down in the Condor Range. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill. Is that the end of public testimony?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
And one thing I'd like to add, there is one piece of the wording proposed by the department that our Deputy Attorney General has a suggested change there. It's a technical nature that I think you'd like to hear before your discussion.
Bill?
Mr. President, members of the Commission, if I might, in listening to the presentation of Dr. Loft as well as some earlier discussions with Mr. Manzel, one of the issues raised is a very minor issue, and that has to do with our definition of projectile and the various proposed regulations. And it has been appropriately pointed out that, unfortunately, when we defined the projectile and the way it was expelled from a firearm, we used by the force of any explosion, and technically that is incorrect. Black powder is an explosive. Smokeless powders are combustibles and are defined as such by the federal law. In fact, you can actually ship them differently because some burn and some explode. So may I suggest that the definition can be refined by eliminating four words out of that discussion of projectile. And the four words I suggest we eliminate are at the very end of the sentence where it speaks to a device which is expelled from a firearm through a barrel by, and I would eliminate the word the, leaving the word force, and then eliminate the last three words of any explosion. So the sentence would read, for purposes of this section, a projectile as defined as any bullet, ball, sabot, slug, buckshot, or other device which is expelled from a firearm through a barrel by force, period.
Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you.
Okay. John?
Yes, and that would be for 353 and 475, all definitions of
all
projectile.
All definitions.
Yes.
Thank you, John. Okay, discussion by the commission.
Do we want to go through these items?
I think so, one by one.
One by one and just see where
we're at. See where we all are.
Where we're at. Geographic area.
Do you have a suggestion?
You know, my suggestion would be that we stay consistent with the NAVA bill at this point in time.
Okay. Any further commentary?
Well, yeah, I mean, just that's the minimum we're stuck with is what the NAVA bill was. I kind of like the geographical jurisdiction. There was a real geographical jurisdiction that we were considering when we were trying to get this done.
You mean the current and historic range? Is that what you're referring to, Jim?
The historic geographical range of the condor.
Okay.
And I would like to get a clarification of from Eric Loft of your proposal was to add to the NAVA bill the southern part of Zone A.
I think Commissioner Roger or Commissioner Kellogg that the map that you looked at.
I don't want to be him.
Yeah. I'm looking at you. I believe our map was in error, and our proposal would be the NAVA bill. So the graphic that is on the map, I think, includes that little wedge that you highlighted. We would go with what the NAVA bill says.
Any other comments or questions on the on number one, Zonkey?
Yeah, just for the record, I want to make it clear, the in the presentation and the handout you received today, there is a slight error below Highway 58. There's a little wedge that doesn't belong there, but in the in your regulatory eyesore, it is correct.
Okay.
So just so no, there's no confusion, we're, we should be referencing the map in the eyesore.
In the eyesore.
Right.
Everyone comfortable with that? Cindy, why don't you keep going, if you wish?
Sure. On the definition of projectile, I would go with the department's recommendation on that.
As modified by...
Right, as modified by Mr. Cunningham.
Any questions about that or commentary? Any further? Zonkey?
Yeah, I just want to make it very clear that the commission understands what they would be doing by adopting the definition of projectiles. Again, part of our reason, as you heard in earlier testimony, department is to clean up some ambiguities in our own definitions. But be clear, based on previous direction from the commission, if you adopt the proposed definition of projectiles, you will be including methods that were not specifically addressed in NAVA. For example, muzzleloaders will clearly be in compliance, as will be 22s for other non-game. So be aware that taking that definition automatically sucks in those calibers into the requirements in the of lead-free. Fair notice.
Understand. Any further questions or comments on that particular one? Cindy, you're doing such a great job leading this discussion.
Sure. On the lead threshold, I again agree with the department. I can't see reducing that beyond that or increasing it. And it seems from the manufacturers that that is doable and reasonable.
Any questions or comments from the commission?
Just
Mr. Sutton.
I suppose, I mean, that's fine, but we ought to, I'd like to hear back from the condo recovery team as their research or as their study of the lead threshold issue proceeds, just to see whether that's...
On an ongoing basis.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I think that goes for everything we're doing. I mean, I agree with that, Commissioner Sutton.
Yeah, this is a living document, as is all of our rulings. Next one?
I guess item on the Wildcats and the use of 22, I would say no change on the Wildcats, no exemption. And I would agree with prohibiting the 22s. Now, my concern here is obviously there is an alternative ammunition source, but I've really thought about this, and I think all of you know, and I've stated for the public record, I'm concerned about lead in the environment. Yes, it's a concern to condors, but I'm also concerned with lead in the environment, and I've seen, you know, what we've done in waterfowl. I've also seen... I think it's in Vermont that they're now banning lead fishing weights. Lead is a toxin. Lead is bad in our environment for humans and critters and in many ways. So I would prefer to go ahead and prohibit it. I am concerned if there isn't an alternative found, I'd like to keep it open to revisit this for use under certain types of permitting for farmers and ranchers at some point. Maybe a year from now we reconsider that if the manufacturers don't catch up with us, because I am concerned about banning something that might be useful to them, but I want to do it in such a limited manner that we can ensure proper disposal. And I don't know that we get that just by approving it. I think we put a real burden on the enforcement team to try to determine what people are using that lead for or not. So that I guess that's where I stand on that issue. And I'm sure there's other commissioners who feel differently, but I'd love to talk about that.
Yeah, with all due respect to my fellow commissioner, I think that we need to... Now that we've taken the giant step, we need to take baby steps to make sure that what we're doing is the right thing. And I personally believe, and each one of us has got our own opinion on each one of these issues, I know. And I know that we all get very passionate about it and sometimes make foolish statements. But I believe that that we should allow the 22 and the black powder with the condition that the hunters are required to dispose of the carcasses of the animals they shoot with those. And let's see how that works. We can come back and change this if it doesn't work.
Commissioner Sutton.
I guess my concern is the testimony we've heard about from a number of people this morning regarding the opportunistic scavenging of condors and where they are picking up non-game carcasses that have been shot with lead ammunition. I would favor prohibiting lead projectiles, our option on the table for hunting non-game with 22 caliber and smaller rimfire. I think one of the things that would immediately do is give the bullet manufacturers a tremendous incentive to develop a 22 non-toxic round for 22 caliber rifles.
Okay. Any further commentary or questions? Okay, Cindy, do you want to continue?
Well, I think that affects then possessing lead projectile while hunting. I would, again, support the department's position on that.
Any questions or comments? Commissioner Sutton.
Well, again, as I've said before, this is a really important issue for the enforceability of this. And as President Rogers pointed out, for 20 years this has been the case with steel shot for waterfowl hunting. I have the scar tissue of having implemented that 20 years ago when I was working for the Fish and Wildlife Service. And a possession regulation is really the only one that will work here. So I support the department's position as well.
Any further comments on that one? And then the last one, I guess, just the implementation date.
Right, just the recommended date, July 1, 2008.
The recommended date. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I think how would we wish to proceed? I would think that if maybe what we could do is read the suggested motion, but then we'll have to go down through each one of these things and probably vote on what that suggested motion encompasses, right, John? Because each one of these is an element within that.
Right. Well, my understanding is I can read the suggested motion with the technical information, and then I believe Commissioner Gustafson has a additional motion that could be attached to that, which will encompass everything here and move that to a vote.
All right, and that'll have to be a roll call, I'm sure. All right.
So starting with the staff suggestion on the technical, the Fish and Game Commission, pursuant to the authority vested by sections 200, 202, 203, 355, 3003.1, 3800, and 4150 of the Fish and Game Code, and to implement, interpret, or make specific sections 200, 202, 203, 203.1, 207, 355, 356, 2005, 2055, 3004.5, 3800, 3950, and 4150 of said code, hereby amend sections 353 and 475, Title 14, CCR, related to methods authorized for taking big game and methods of take for non-game birds and non-game mammals. Further, the Commission directs staff to prepare a notice of determination consistent with the approval and adoption of associated regulations. This notice of determination is to be filed with the Secretary for Resources pursuant to 781.5 Title 14 and Section 21080.5 of the Public Resources Code. Please note the regulatory language will be included as an appendix in the Commission Office Master Minutes.
And we would vote on the geographic area separately then?
No, that will be part of Commissioner. This is all going to be
all as one motion.
And I'll add to what I just read, Bill Cunningham's suggestion on projectile, and then Commissioner Gustafson can add to this.
Okay.
Mr. President, if I might.
Wait a minute now. Before you do, Bill, as a commissioner, I want to make sure I understand what you just said, John. You said we're going to adopt that motion as you read. We had options on each one of these.
Right. And I'm sorry if I wasn't clear. My motion is not finished. Commissioner Gustafson then is going to add to that motion, which will clarify those.
Each one of those points.
And if after Commissioner Gustafson's motion, if you want to go back, I think that there's latitude for that, if you want to go piece by piece.
And Mr. President, if I might, I'm sorry to interrupt. Mr. Master called to my attention something that I had thought about and then immediately dismissed. The definition that I've now suggested be clarified on projectiles will have an effect that may or may not be something that all of you are aware of. By including a projectile that is just ejected from a firearm by force, that could also be defined or seen as precluding the use of pellet guns, which used compressed air or CO2 to expel a pellet or projectile from a barrel. And for usually those projectiles are also lead. Some pellet guns are used for non-game small mammals. However, I'm not sure that a pellet gun is considered a firearm, which is the rest of our definition. So I just wanted to call this to your attention.
I don't think it is considered a firearm.
I don't think
That's not a legal opinion on my part.
Well, certainly I didn't want to preempt Commissioner Kellogg if you had a motion you wanted to make. I've just been working, trying to pull the pieces together.
You were looking for clarification.
I just wanted to make it clear that we were going to come back and do this.
Okay. Well, my recommendations then would be to specify in the regulations the prohibition and possession of lead projectiles as defined by the department's preferred alternative and amended by our legal counsel today, having 1% or more lead content by weight for both big game and non-game birds and mammals in the geographic area defined by AB 821, with no exemption for obsolete wildcats or .22 calibers, and having an implementation date of July 1, 2008. And I think that codifies all the options we just discussed in that a little bit different order.
Do I hear a second to that motion?
I'll second that with a question.
Please.
Regarding possession, your motion incorporated possession.
Possession.
Yes,
it did.
The prohibition and possession of lead projectiles as defined.
Second.
And amended.
Okay, discussion.
On a discussion, Mr. President, I can't vote in favor of the motion, and with that one exception in there, and that's it, is not exempting the .22 caliber and the other deals. And there's a whole bunch goes into that. I mean, I requested a couple of years ago that we give an opportunity in the Condor Range to educate hunters and see if that could help. And that was really never was done. We made an attempt, but there was never any results, nothing done. And now we're going to exempt .22s without giving the opportunity for the real true hunters to come up to the plate. And I made a comment about everybody gets emotional on these issues and says things that don't make a lot of sense to me sometimes. And one of those statements was made yesterday when all hunters were painted with a brush that they're alcoholics and drug addicts. And that's just not fair. It's not fair at all. Our state Senate, our state assembly, our U.S. Congress and U.S. Senate have the same problems with drug addicts and alcoholics as everybody in this room does in their business life. There's not anybody sitting in this audience that doesn't have a relative or a friend or somebody that they can relate to with those kind of problems. Yet we've got people that get emotional about these issues and they try to paint the entire hunting community with that same brush. And that's not fair. The hunters, in my opinion, and a lot of other people's opinion, are the people who have made the hunting wildlife in this state survive as it is today, where we have a lot less opportunity for endangered species like the California condor, is because of the hunters money and effort that they put in trying to maintain that hunting heritage. And it's just not, I mean, I agree with everything in this motion except for that part. And the hunters are taking a big hit. And in my opinion, we still don't know. I mean, I said it in the beginning, if we outlawed hunting altogether in the condor range, the condors are still going to be dying from lead poisoning. And I think we just have to take smaller steps, baby steps, or however you want to define it, and not do it all at once. We still have to wait and see if the legislature's going to stay solid on non-lead ammunition, meaning non-lead ammunition. Because if they don't change that, then we're not going to have hunting at all down there, because there is no such thing as non-lead ammunition. So let's just, I mean, go ahead with your motion. And but I want, Steve, make sure that I'm on the damn internet so the hunters know that they got a friend on this commission anyway.
I'd like to interject something right here, Jim. You know, I'm in complete sympathy with your commentary about the dissing, as if you will, of hunters. Not to single Cindy out, she just happens to not be one, but three of the four of us sitting up here are hunters. We view ourselves as conservationists. We wouldn't dream of doing the things I mean, my God. Anyway, you know, it's insulting, frankly, to have that our community, and I believe all of us feel that way. I've been a hunter my entire life, and I didn't like being painted in that manner either. So I'm in complete sympathy with your commentary in that regard.
Did you want to speak on the 22 issue? Because I'd like to hear both of your opinions on that issue.
Go ahead.
And I need to interject again that I have the greatest respect for hunters, my colleagues here, as well as many of my friends and family who do hunt. So that is not the issue. I may not choose to participate, but I totally disagreed with the comments yesterday, and I echo Jim's concern about that.
And that's my whole point, that given the opportunity, the hunters will work with this, and they will pick up their carcasses if they're out there doing that. And if we give it some time, we will learn. Either they do or they don't, and at that time we can revisit it.
And again, I want to clarify that my issue is not about hunting; it's about lead. And I just want to be really clear about that.
Okay. I certainly understand and sympathize with Commissioner Kellogg's perspective entirely. The part of the commentary yesterday with which I had to agree, though, is that as long as our community, hunters and gun owners, are perceived as being more concerned about their guns and bullets than they are about wildlife, we have a problem. Because most people in California are not hunters, and they care more about wildlife than they do about hunting and firearms, and we have to be mindful of that. That said, my support for the proposed motion is not based on a motion. It's based on the testimony we've heard this morning about the predation or scavenging of non-game species and pigs that have been shot by .22 ammunition. We've heard pretty persuasive testimony all along, in fact, about that. And as Commissioner Gustafson has pointed out, this issue is not is fundamentally about removing lead from the condor's diet and environment. And that is why I am in support of the motion as it's proposed. I think if we leave any source of lead ammunition available to the condor to get into the condor's food chain, we will be violating the spirit of what we're trying to do here.
Rather than repeat what everyone has said, I agree with Commissioner Gustafson and Commissioner Sutton in this regard. I understand the problem with the .22. But I really do believe that there are alternatives in predation hunts, and I also believe that in a relatively short period of time, the ammunition manufacturers will come up with the appropriate methodology for the .22 owners. And I also view this as a lead in the environment issue. I don't think that it's appropriate to be using lead in the environment. No matter how careful guys tend to be, they'll often be ones that get away and run off into the bush and end up dying, and that is often the case. I'm not suggesting that hunters are necessarily bad shots, just that it does happen. I've shot some ducks that I know were with steel shot, but they ended up going someplace that not even my dog could find. So I'm concerned about that. And that's my sense of it. So
just one more comment. I just think that we could define depredation permits to require the disposal of the pigs or whatever. I mean, there's not one of them ranchers out there that doesn't have some kind of a tractor or something they can dig a hole and bury the things when they shoot them, and they haven't been required to do that before. That's why there's still dead pigs laying out there with lead in them. But if we make a requirement as a condition of a depredation permit that they have to dispose of the carcasses where they're not available to the critters out there, then you wouldn't have that.
Yeah. Okay, any further discussion?
We have
a proposed motion.
Right, I need to make sure the motion, Mr. Cunningham wanted me to make sure that on the record I stated that this is with no exemption for obsolete wildcats or .22 calibers or less for rimfires.
Right.
So just to make sure that's clarified.
And it was seconded, I believe.
Yes.
Okay, I think we should, do we need a roll call, do you think, or not? Let's go for a roll call.
Okay. Commissioner Sutton?
Aye.
Commissioner Gustafson?
Aye.
Commissioner Kellogg?
No.
Commissioner Rogers?
Aye.
Motion carries 3-1.
Should we take a break? Let's take a 15-minute break.
I understand.
The session will commence again. Thank you for allowing us our break. But before we proceed any further, Commissioner Kellogg would like to make a comment.
I see that most of the audience has left, but maybe there's somebody still on the internet paying attention to us. I just wanted to wrap up that last vote with a comment about the uniqueness of this commission and the diversity of the different commissioners on here, and the fact that that's what makes this a great commission. And then I wanted to also say, just for my own personal benefit, this is not a gun and bullets issue to me. It's a hunter's issue. I actually despise the NRA, and it's not a gun and bullet thing to me. It's strictly a human being hunting issue to me, and I appreciate the views of the rest of the commission, and wouldn't change the diversity of this commission for anything. So that's all I wanted to say.
Well, I'd like to go on record, Jim. Thank you for those comments. I'd like to go on record and saying that I wouldn't mind being you, even though you don't want to be me.
Might have it as both.
John, go ahead.
That middle name you were talking about a while ago could change real quick.
M-U-D.
One last thing that I'd like to bring up, commissioners, is that under 16B in parenthetical, we did say that this item will include discussion on implementation of ABA 21, and a lot of that discussion did occur. But there is another piece that I wanted to just make clear to everyone,
that in February the department will be bringing an eyesore on the other pieces that NAVA requires, and one of those pieces is the bullet certification. And then also there's some cleanup that's going to be needed in the regular, the routine mammal regulatory package that will be brought forward in February. So there will be a couple of pieces, and some of the folks who said that this is not over, well, it's not over. They're right. There's going to be some pieces that will be considered, and I just wanted to bring that forward and open that up to commissioner discussion.
Well, and in the spirit of its not being over, I'd like to make a motion for the commission for another motion for the commission for guidance to the department. And let me read this motion and we can discuss it and chat about it. I'd like to move to request that the Department of Fish and Game complete a comprehensive review of the best available science regarding lead bullet shot toxicity impacts to wildlife, including game birds and raptors, on a statewide basis, and provide a written summary to the commission for consideration at its February 2009 meeting. So that's February 2009. That's after we've had an opportunity to see what's going on. The summary should include Department of Fish and Game recommendations regarding possible additional regulatory changes or changes to the existing regulation to protect wildlife from exposure to lead. That is a motion I would like to make. Do I hear a second? And then, of course, we can discuss it.
Second.
Okay, any discussion?
The only question I might have is whether the department, given the tremendous amount of information already available on this subject, whether the department might be able to get something to us before February 09.
Sonke, do you have a comment about that? Because my understanding was that by February 09 was what the department was comfortable with in terms of getting your hands around the issue writ slightly larger.
Well, the answer has several parts. One, obviously, based on the action the commission has just taken, we're going to be, my staff, the Wildlife Programs Branch and Enforcement, are going to have to do a very significant PR outreach program, because this is going to affect the behavior of a lot of individuals.
Right.
So that's going to keep us pretty busy through July. Now, as it comes to the science on these other issues, the other raptors and other animals on lead, we have been looking at that. It gets a lot less definitive, quite honestly. Given that the NAVA bill requires an annual report back on condor health, we would recommend we kind of combine that, since that's already an obligation that in a year, which is about
February 09.
I think that's a reasonable time to kind of come to you with a comprehensive look. The department, if it finds it's clear, we certainly could provide it earlier, and we would. It just, based on what we know, there are certainly risks. I think Commissioner Gustafson has made comments to that, concerns to that effect, and you've heard testimony to that effect, and there is some science out there, but cause and effect gets a lot, it's not as definitive, and so I'm not sure when we would be prepared. But
well, particularly now, we all understand that cause and effect on a larger scale, and by that I don't mean necessarily geographically. What I mean is
right
in terms of
the
other
species affected,
and species and whatnot, is not as definitive, because nobody has put in the effort
right
that has been placed on the condor. Having said that, if the scientific community and the NGOs understand that what we want to do is look at this in a very comprehensive manner, well, probably once a year for a number of years, but all I'm suggesting is that we enshrine this, if we will, into our February 09 meeting, which should give you plenty of time, and only, obviously, if the scientific community and the NGOs respond with the research that allows us to have a definitive opinion. That's really what I mean by that.
Yeah, in the department, you know, it is our obligation to be concerned about the risk and threat of lead. The the good news in that sense in terms of knowledge is there is a lot of research going on this subject.
There is, and it seems to be accelerating.
And so we're going to be in an better and better situation to understand what's really going on with lead and our use of lead and the impact on the environment. So I think the plan here, what I'm hearing, and we're certainly will work with you on that, is providing you routine updates when we have, kind of like our commitment with Condor originally, when we had, we said we would come back to you when we had more evidence, and the evidence suggests that perhaps it's time to take action, we would do the same thing.
Well, I also, in speaking in that that spirit, I also think it's important for the commission to go on record to all of the concerned stakeholders here, whether on whatever side, that we do intend to revisit this, and we're setting a date specific for that so that people can understand when we're going to do it and construct their analyses and their commentary to both the department and to the commission to be coincidental with our being able to evaluate that prior to February 09.
Yeah, the department.
It gives some specificity to this concern that we're talking about.
Yeah, and I think the message we're clearly hearing is the commission is not going to ignore this issue. It's interested and wants to continue discussion and dialogue on this and whether there's additional things the commission needs to do to safeguard the state's natural resources.
Yeah, I mean, that's the fundamental. Any questions or comments from the commission?
Yeah, I have. Please. I mean, here I go again. But we had constituent groups over this issue stand up in front of us and say that the Condor was just the beginning. Their real goal is to ban lead statewide. And I don't think that's this commission's job to step out and be the ones that are considering banning lead statewide until we have a heck of a lot more educated opinion rather than just from the special interest group's science. I mean, comments have been made. You made one yourself about, and that's one of those comments I believe you made in a passionate time over this issue, where hunters are killing their families by allowing them to eat the game that they bring home, and the department already is strapped so tight on their budget for the things that they have going that if something like this was in the works for this commission to be involved in, there's been extensive studies done by other states already, you know, on the effect of lead consumption concerning people eating wild game that's been harvested by hunters. And we need to tap into those other studies. And by the way, every single one of those studies done in other states have come, the conclusion was that there were absolutely no health risks to human beings consuming game, wild game taken by hunters as far as lead contamination was. I just don't think that's the job of this commission to be out front in an effort to lead the charge and ban and lead statewide until we have some more educated proof coming from the ban in the Condor area that it indeed is having some kind of an effect on the raptors. I always said from the beginning, show me why the hawks on these game clubs where you're hunting with lead every day are not dying from lead poison, eating and wounded and dead animals that are left out in the field there. And so there's some validity to what I'm saying, that there still is not concrete evidence to justify us at this time, in my opinion, to consider thinking of a statewide ban until we find out what the ban that we've just adopted is doing. We've got a study area right there. Sonke said that the department's already going to expand that study to the other areas that you're talking about in the Condor area. I would rather see this commission learn from taking those little steps I was talking about rather than march toward a big step like that. So.
Jim, I don't disagree with that. And I thought that was inherent. If I didn't say it correctly, I mean to say that I don't want to see this commission get out in front of the science. That's why I'm talking about. I want, what I would like this commission to do, however, is be leaders with respect to lead in the environment. And if, in fact, it does pose a risk to the public trust resources of the state, and in addition to the human beings, yes or no, that we should, I think it's incumbent upon us to take that leadership position, but not to do it emotionally, not to get out in front of the science. Yeah. I agree with you completely. I think you're absolutely
solid ground. I've said it before. There's no question in my mind that lead is harmful to the environment. And the organization I represent in my real job has been out front in that.
Yes,
and
it certainly has.
We actually have bills that had to be vetoed because in the legislature over an attempt to ban lead in faucets for your homes
for a long time,
but we couldn't do it because there is no faucets made that don't have some lead content in it.
Well, we're probably going to have to, within the next 6 months or so, ban the use of Chinese toys to kill game animals too.
But
anyway,
I just want us to be smart about what we're doing.
Okay. Is there any further commentary then? We had a motion and a second. Mm-hmm. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
No.
No. Okay. Motion passes. Thank you. John?
Thank you, Commissioners. That moves us to item 17, discussion and possible adoption of proposed changes to the sport fish regulations to modify report card structure for abalone, sturgeon, steelhead, and salmon, and to establish a lobster report card. And my understanding is Marcy Uremko will give a presentation on this, and we might see a draft videotape here.
Ooh.
Sorry. Good morning still, Commissioners. Marcy Uremko with the department. Just like to take a quick second to review the major components of the package that's in front of you, which would amend the regulations governing sport fishing report card and tagging requirements. The regulations would apply to fishing activity and take of Klamath salmon, sturgeon, steelhead, abalone, and lobster, so five key species. And the major changes that would apply to all five of these report card programs, again, just that the cards would be required on free fishing days, and that all individuals fishing for or taking those species would be required to have a card, and that would include children and fishing from public piers. Any other place where a license isn't required, you'd still need a card. Specific changes for each card program. Quickly, the changes to the salmon card. Right now, the rules require the card in some portions of ocean waters. That would be repealed, and the requirement would be effective only for waters of the Klamath Trinity watershed. For abalone, you'll be hearing more about it, but we propose to add a tagging requirement to improve enforcement of the annual bag limit of 24 per year and 3 per day. And the addition of a lobster report card. Right now, we don't have a report card requirement for lobster. We would be adding one with this action. And that is geared primarily to collect catch and effort data for this fishery because we do not have that information, the recreational lobster fishery. At this point, we have virtually no information on levels of catch and effort. There is one decision that you will be needing to make. In this package, there's an option for abalone that would provide an exception for those who are diving from non-motorized vessels. And that exception would allow these cardholders to return to the shore or to a motorized vessel before they would be required to fill out or tag the abalone. The other alternative, of course, is that they would be required to immediately fill out the card and perform the tagging when they get back aboard their kayak. So that option is available to you. For all other programs where we have tagging requirements, the rules are very clear. You immediately have to tag the animal, whether it be a deer, a sturgeon. And the immediacy requirement is very important. We've talked about that. So that option is available to you to give the non-motorized craft, water, or vessel users a brief respite from the rule, just in time to get back to a more stable platform or to the shore. So with that, you've heard a little bit about this. We mentioned it at the last meeting that we feel very strongly that if we are going to impose new rules such as this, that we do the best we can to educate the public on the changed requirements and procedures. So over the past month, and of course this is pending your adoption today of this action, we've put together this is a short, rough draft compilation of what we propose to post on YouTube or another host site. It's a brief video demonstration of how to comply with the new abalone tagging and reporting requirements. So with that, let's go ahead and...
I never thought I'd see the day when YouTube was part of the official regulatory implementation program of the department.
We estimate that over 250,000 abalone are poached off the north coast of California every year. In order to continue this sport fishery and further protect the resource, new regulations have been adopted by the California Fish and Game Commission. This video will provide guidance and help you comply with those new regulations.
I see a fishing net. Do you have a fishing net?
Yeah,
got one right here. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Is this your daughter?
Yeah. She's pretty excited. This is her first time getting to go abalone diving, so she's thrilled.
Right on. Just to let you know, as of 2008, the rules have changed, so everybody is required to have an abalone card. So even if you are not required to have a fishing license, you're required to have an abalone card.
So even children have to have an abalone card?
Correct, yes.
Okay.
Got all your stuff?
Yeah, got my card. I'm going to put it in this bag and hope it stays dry.
Hey, how are you guys doing today?
Hey, howdy. Pretty good.
How you doing?
Good. You guys getting ready to go diving?
Yep.
All right. Now, you know, we've implemented some new regulations for this year.
Yeah. Yes.
Have any questions?
Well, we were talking about it before you got here. We're trying to figure it all out.
So there's a sequential number on the bottom of the bag itself, and the last two digits are going to correspond with the number up there.
That's right.
And
just like
the information is like the top, the month, the day, the time, and the location code where we're diving.
That's right.
All right.
Find the location code on the back.
And then we punch out that hole there and put the zip tie through there and attach it to the abalone.
Check us on the way in. Hopefully we'll have something to show you.
All right. Good luck, guys.
Thanks.
Great dive.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to fill out the top part like we did before.
Get it?
Yeah, got the first one. And then the second one. Yeah. That's not so bad. That's pretty easy, actually.
he's on. All right. I gotta new rules. I gotta make sure I fill
in. Big abalone, Sonky.
And tag my abalone before I leave this spot, since I'm supposed to immediately fill out the card in a motorized craft.
It was a plant, right? Oh, Beal's blowing the whistle.
We know that these new regulations add a few extra steps to your dive, but they're really important to help protect the resource. So thank you. So,
yay.
We estimate that over 250. So that's just a preview. There will be a full-length edition, and we'd really like to take a chance to thank Matt Eliash, who worked very long and hard over the past week just to put together these little segments for you today to give you a flavor of what's to come, as well as Deborah Hamilton, also in our audiovisual unit, and Carrie Wilson as well, and all of the other department personnel who participated. And also a special thanks to our volunteers, non-department people, Jack Likens. He was one of the models in the diving chute. He volunteered his time and spent the day with us out there on the North Coast, gave us some insight being a local resident, as well as our special volunteer, Crystal Keller, who was eager to be our young abalone diver. So with that, I'll take any questions about the proposal.
Any questions or comments? Just one quick comment. I am really glad that you made the exceptions. You added lobster and you made the exceptions for what has come to be called the plastic navy or something they're calling it. I don't know if you probably are quite aware that the explosion in hoop net fishing, at least in Southern California, for lobster. And the guys are being very successful with a little put on top of your small car kayak and getting out there and getting lobster. It's an absolutely wonderful fishery. But not understanding what that take is and what the biology is really very important for us to avoid. So
exactly.
We really want to understand that. And because it's just great that these guys are able to do that. You know, they can live in Bakersfield and be out there catching lobster that evening. It's great.
Others.
Okay. No questions, no comments? John?
Thank you.
Good job.
We do have a few public speakers on this issue. We'll start with John Duffy, followed by Jim Martin, followed by Milo Vojkovic. 3 minutes each, please.
Hello, John.
Good morning, President Rogers, members of the commission. My name is John Duffy. And I'm speaking today on my own behalf and perhaps that of hundreds of unaffiliated recreational divers. I wrote to you at the end of last month to express my concerns regarding the proposed lobster report card. One of my concerns was in not knowing how many entries there would be on the card. In response to my letter, I did receive a copy of the draft report card on Monday of this week. It has room for 56 entries, which is probably enough so that most people will not have to buy a second card. However, receipt of the draft report card does not address all of my concerns about information that the department does have that could have been provided to the commission and the public in determining if this regulation is needed. We've heard that there's not much information available, but there is some, and none of it was provided to you or the public to review. I am in support of obtaining data to use in managing our valuable marine resources, especially including spiny lobster. And I certainly understand the department's financial constraints in collecting that data. I believe that the Administrative Procedure Act is going to require an additional public comment period on the content and structure of the lobster report card because it was not provided in any to the public at all. During this comment period, I again asked the Commission to direct the department to explore a public-private partnership with Southern California Dive Clubs that I described in my earlier letter. In addition, I'd like to call to your attention, and to the departments also, that the proposed lobster report card is based on a calendar year. I presume to fit within the box of the calendar-based license year, while the fishery itself is based on the biological consideration of the spawning cycle. That's why the season opens in the fall of one year and closes in the spring of the next. The department, and in turn the public, would be much better served in analyzing this collected data if it relates to the seasonal cycle rather than a calendar year cycle. During my tenure as a department biologist, I spent a lot of time examining the periodicity of commercial lobster catches, which are reported on a calendar year basis in the landing records. I had to regroup that data into seasonal base in order to make any sense out of it. I strongly recommend that the report card be made valid for the course of the open season, as is done with abalone right now. Otherwise, a person's going to buy a report card in January, use it for January, February, and part of March, and then it's going to be sitting around who knows where until the season opens again in October. Good chance it'll get lost or misplaced or whatever. The report card itself provides a code for each of the eight Channel Islands plus Tanner and Cortez banks in the offshore area. Then 69 other codes along the coast from the U.S.-Mexico border through San Luis Obispo County. I'd sure like to hear from the department an explanation as to why they deem it necessary to have such fine detail along the coast and such broad coverage at the offshore locations, specifically with references to how that data would be used in managing the fishery. There are other fine points of concern that simply cannot be covered in 3 minutes, so let me make these recommendations. The report card should be made valid for the duration of the open season, October through March. I think the reporting codes for the mainland should be reduced to at least half, and no report card should be required north of Point Conception in Santa Barbara County. There is so little catch and effort in that portion of the range of the lobster that it's burdensome, really. And I think the department should add a 3-year sunset to the lobster report card requirement because the department has justified this program on a need for data to manage the fishery. And based on their failure to include any reference to the data collected for 10 years on abalone report cards, if the department follows through with an analysis that shows a need for continued data collection beyond 3 years, it's a simple enough process to remove the sunset date from your regulations. With these changes, I would then support the establishment of a lobster report card. I do want to
summarize, too, John.
This is the summary of the overall proposal that requires a report card of all anglers, regardless of age, and in all locations, including where no license is required, and at all times, including free fishing days. I simply can't buy into the need for requiring a 14-year-old, 15-year-old child to possess a lobster report card. I have over 50 years of personal diving experience, sport diving for lobster. The catch rate of people that age is negligible. And it's not in the spirit of this department or commission through my tenure to put that kind of a burden on kids. I get very clearly that there's a lot of concern with poaching in the abalone fishery and that there's some valid enforcement concerns that are trying to be addressed by this, but it's done under the cover of the need for more data, and I can't buy that. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, John. Sankey, John raises an interesting point. The question of the season in particular, he raised several interesting points, but that one. A card for the 08-09 season, or, you know,
that is a conundrum created by the fishing license, which is by the calendar year. Because you need to record it on
have to have a license.
Yeah, we have the same problem with the salmon steelhead report card. This is not a new problem. We looked at a lot of ways to get around that, and currently our current fishing license structure doesn't really make that workable. We do realize it's an inconvenience. Fortunately, we believe that most lobster fishermen are going to buy their card before the opener in October, and the information we typically anecdotally are aware of, that fishing tends to start dropping off through the remainder of the season, and by after the first of the year, the activity gets much lower. There will be people buying their card in January that may lose it and have to buy another one for the next October. But given the value of this resource and the value that fishermen place on it, I don't think it's overly burdensome. And I just want to make one note on the child requirement. It is very new. This is a first for us. But as you are well aware, the expectation of data and our ability to properly manage these resources, while Mr. Duffy's absolutely right on the diver, I do not see much diver pressure on lobsters. But hoop netting is a completely different story. And as you pointed out, it's a major growth area in this fishery. And children are very much a big part of this fishery. And for us to properly manage it, we're just looking at capturing as much data as we can so we understand this fishery so you can make sound decisions. On another note, we believe a sunset is unnecessary because every year is a sunset year in front of the commission. Any year you have an opportunity to go to a rulemaking. Our goal with all these report cards is to come to you with the summary of the data we collected the previous year so you can judge how things are going. We'd come to you with recommendations. We view this as an adaptive process, and we hope to learn much, and we'll probably come to you with modifications as we go. But okay. We believe this is a reasonable starting point, particularly considering all these fisheries are highly valuable, and they're all coming under increasing pressure, and we think it's only wise to have as much available information available to you as possible so you can properly manage this fishery.
Thank you, Sunky. We have more public commentary.
Jim Martin.
Any further questions, Commissioner? No. Okay.
Jim Martin, followed by Milo Vojkovic, followed by Paul Weakland.
Thank you, President Jim? Rogers. Jim Martin with the Recreational Fishing Alliance. Excuse me, I have a little cold here and I'm fighting it. We're generally supportive of these regulations. One comment I had in the purpose section of the additional regulations, it says that these are, one of the reasons is that these are of high commercial value, and I think most of these species are not even commercially fished, so if you could just strike commercially valuable and just say valuable, I don't think that's a substantive change, but the other... One issue I do have is, I support John Duffy's request for a sunset on this, and a lot of these tags have been introduced with the promise that we're going to get some great data out of them, and it hasn't happened. I went a few years after they instituted the abalone card and asked for some of that data for a book I was doing on fishing the North Coast, and I asked him, where are they getting the most landings of abalone? What are the hot spots? Is it Van Dam or whatnot? He said, well, we haven't had time to enter these in. We don't have the money for it. And actually, the first time I've even seen any kind of reference to that data is when John Ugaritz put the in the regional profile spots where most of these abalone. So it was used in the MLPA. That data was used to close down areas, but it was never available to the public. I have the same problem with steelhead card. You know, where do we get the data on where people are catching fish? It's useful. So I have a concern about that. And also I think we'd like to ask that the lobster portion of these regulations be delayed until we solve the issue of Section 711, and I know Commissioner Sutton's taking that up at the next Marine Resources Committee. I think that's what's happening. That and among all other things, because we're being asked to pony up $500,000 here, and we just don't think that's fair. On the abalone tags, this is going to be controversial, but we do support it. We see that this is primarily to get a handle on the gifting and poaching of abalone. On this set of regulations, we would support option two of the two different options that you're offered. And that's my comment. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jim.
Milo Vojkovic, followed by Paul Weakland.
Milo Vojkovic, president of Sonoma County Abalone Network, also known as SCAN. We support abalone tags and option two. Option two eliminates a lot of negative and unnecessary contact that legal divers have had with law enforcement. Nobody on a kayak soaking wet should be trying to fill out one of these cards, and then the tag is going to be even smaller with a pen that's freezing cold and won't write. So that person should get back to shore before they try to fill that out. That was a bad law that we had before. It should be rectified now. It also resolves the problem with defining what a vessel is. We've had people written up for coming in on a boogie board, and they said, well, that's transportation over water, so that's a vessel, and wrote them up. And that's not Nancy's people, because they're usually better than that. But you get park rangers, sheriffs, all kinds of people reading this thing and trying to enforce it. It's been nothing but a problem. Go with option two. Lobster cards, I want to thank Nancy and Marcy for working with me on changing the wording that we had in the abalone fishery of 500 yards on the shore. We changed it to 500 yards from point of entry into the ocean. That'll resolve a lot of the conflict problems we'd have right there. The big problem we have with this, and we're asking you to delay this till next year, because we don't think it's fair at all that we should kick in another $525,000 while commercial fishing pays $94,000 total, including landing tax, and pulls out $8 million out of that fishery every year. And you're asking recreational anglers to pony up without resolving that issue. So that kind of adds insult to injury, really. So we're asking you to take that up and pass both things at the same time. Other than that, we don't oppose it, and we know the hoop net situation is changing the fishery, so we want that data too. And we know the department's going to say, let's do it now. We need that data, but I'm the guy that goes back and faces the angry mob about this stuff. So I'd rather go back and say we resolved the whole issue at one time and not create all that animosity between recreational anglers.
Just a quick question. As Jim Martin suggested, we're going to take up the issue of fees for management of fisheries at our next MRC meeting in Monterey next week. Where did you get the figures that you just cited for the fees that are paid by the commercial fishing?
Well, the operator permit is $63,812 last year. The crew permit was $20,626, and the landing taxes was about $9,500. So I don't see that they're paying anything more than that. And if you total it, that's $94,000. It came right off the DFG website. So if it's wrong, I'll have to take it up with Sonke. The $8 million is right off the DFG website, too. It was almost 900,000 pounds they landed, and it said the value was worth $8 million. So that's actually a fishery that can afford to pay their own way, yet we're not in compliance with the law. So we're going to ask recreational anglers to kick in another $500,000. It's just going to create more animosity. They're going to say we got the shaft again, and I don't want to have to talk about that with them. I'd rather just do it the proper way.
Fair. Thank you, Mr. Vojkovic. Marcy, did you want to make a comment? You look like you did. Wait till you come to the mic and identify yourself.
Marcy Ramko with the department. I just wanted to confirm the information Milo provided for you, as well as to refer you to the commercial cost report, where all of that statistical information on value, price per pound, landings tax, revenue generated, and permit fees, all of that's provided for you in tabular summary form for all of our major commercial fisheries.
Yeah, thank you, Marcy. Go ahead.
Paul Weakland.
Commissioners, Paul Weakland. Once again, there is no criteria for failure for any of this theory, flawed concepts, or to prove the facts. Now we must have a card at all times. Well, that ends, or there will be no more free fishing days. You cannot say that you have to have a card all the time and say that it's a free fishing day. The end of the free fishing days. It's over. Okay, more modifications on filling out the card. Okay, let's modify some more. How do you prevent the misinterpretation of the information? We have seen over and over that the manufacturing of data is just a wonderful thing for your grant suckers. And we still question the tags have not stopped poaching. No, deer and bear have been tagged for a long time, yet the poaching is unstopped. But these tags were advertised as the way to stop the poaching, and it has not. Report cards have not stopped the poaching, and they never will. We question the cost of the printing of the tags and the report cards, the cost versus the benefits, the personnel required to judge, gauge, and evaluate this information that supposedly is going to be derived, which has been questioned by everyone. Zonke said at the last meeting that the really important thing is the location. The rest of the information really isn't going to do him any good, but he says location. Well, that's the first thing that a fisherman is going to fib or flub on, because the location of their secret spots are the last thing they're giving up. Unbelievable. And how can you guarantee that any of the information that's put down on the report card is honest or accurate? Cannot. We support a sunset date, this connected with honesty, so we can reevaluate this. And it should be the whole state, these report cards, because somebody just might start finding they're venturing out of their traditional range. That would be a nice thing to know, but we won't. Now, gifting. Well, you gift me a little money, and I'll gift you a little fish. This is the worst part of the whole program right there. It is an unusual burden to fill out a report card. I've never liked report cards my whole life. Now I got to have one when I go fishing, just to ride taking the pleasure out of it. The number of fishermen is the most important thing. Make them pay a small fee for a stamp to cover the cost of the printing of the stamp. This stamp can also be paid for a person to honestly evaluate the information, which is going to be meaningless in the long run, which is readily considered the truth. Goodbye.
Thank you, Bob. Okay. John?
That's the end of public comment. Staff has a suggested motion.
Go ahead and read that motion. Or any commentary before that?
No.
No. Go ahead and read the motion.
Fish and Game Commission, pursuant to the authority vested by Sections 200, 202, 205, 219, 220, 240, 713, 1050, 1053, 1055, 1055.1, 5521, and 7149.8, and others that are in the record here in front of you, of the Fish and Game Code to implement, interpret, or make specific Sections 200 through 7382, which are all in the record of said code, hereby amend sections 1.74, 5.80, 5.81, 5.87, 27.90, 27.91, 27.92, 29.15, 29.90, and 701, and add sections 5.79, 5.88, 29.16, and 29.91 of Title 14 related to sport fishing report card and tagging requirements. Please note the regulatory language will be included as an appendix in the Commission Office Master Minutes.
Do I hear that motion?
Second.
Any discussion?
Sonke has it.
Yeah, I think Marcy pointed out, and a couple of speakers, we just need clarification whether you're choosing, as you get to the abalone, whether you're choosing option one or option two, just so we understand exactly what option you're picking.
Okay. Does the proposer of the motion want to make that distinction, please?
And option two was the kayaks can come to shore or non-motorized vehicles. I'm in support of option two. Are you, Jim?
Yeah. Include that in the motion.
Thank you. That's included. Any further discussion?
So otherwise, these are the department proposals in option two for clarification.
And option two.
Okay.
Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? No. It's carried.
4-0 motion carries. I'd also just like to add, as you noticed at the beginning here, Marcy mentioned this was on YouTube. The department is, this was kind of revolutionary for the department.
the YouTube issue came out of a leadership academy the department had 2 years ago, which one of our staff was in, which, you know, to try to connect with the public in a much more effective way. And I think that this is going to pay off. And the one question I had for the department was, can you get a measurement of the number of hits on your YouTube postings?
Yes, you can.
So, I mean, have you gotten that? Do you have any? I mean, I know this is really new right now, but have you gotten any indication of how this is going?
Well, we haven't posted anything yet on YouTube. Our intent is to. And as you well aware and you hear by testimony, there's a lot of uncertainty and ambiguity about what our rules require. And the problem is folks don't have the time or the ability to read half the time all our detail. And we're really hoping a visual, as you saw just little snippets of it, a visual demonstration of what we expect in terms of behavior by the fishermen, we believe will be a lot more effective at reaching a lot of our audience, including audience that where English is not necessarily the first language, because the visual actions are almost universal, whereas the language isn't. So we're kind of hoping that that connects better with some of our constituents. And we may look at doing the same thing with our new Your Actions on Big Game Hunting, is having something visual like this to explain how things have changed and how we expect them to behave, and also help enforcement communicate that too. And we're actually looking for sponsors to create those little mini DVDs where we could hand out this to fishermen who have questions, say, hey, put this in your little device and you can look at what you're actually supposed to do. So we're looking at new media to help really our hunters cope with our regulations.
That's great, and I really appreciate the efforts on your part to do that. It's incredible.
Okay.
Yeah, the visual thing is great. That's why I like menus with pictures of the food. You know, I just point. Moving on to item 18.
You know when to talk. You order the entire menu.
Come on now. Come on. Discussion, number 18, discussion and possible adoption of proposed changes to Section 671, Title 14, related to importation, transportation, and possession of live restricted animals. I believe Sankey, Neil Manji, Scott Barrow gets to say something. They're all pointing at Scott. Scott, I'm afraid you're it.
Can I get a presentation ready to go, please, on 18? Good morning, Commissioner. Scott Barrow, Fisheries Branch. Before I give your presentation on the aquaculture permit, the ability to give an aquaculture permit if we go to restricted species, I just wanted to point you to the fact that this proposal originally was started to make the six species and two genera, which presently can be legally imported, transported, or possessed within California with little or no restrictions. We're trying to get that under control. We also realize that with the modern ability to import species from all over the world into California, we realize that we're going to need to deal with this, the larger aspect for 671. So anyway, to address the question we brought up last meeting, if the species gets unrestricted access, can we issue an aquaculture permit? Left button, correct? Thank you very much. Got it. Presently, back in 1993, as part of the 671 package in Title 14, there is the ability for the commission to issue permits for a species listed under 671 for aquaculture permits. Unfortunately, restricted species permit is actually contained in 671.1, and there was never any stipulation added to that language to allow us to issue a permit, even though we have the ability to issue the permit if it's listed. So basically, presently in 671.1, we have this list of permits: animal care for pet purposes, exhibiting animals, special event breeder for exhibitor, for breeding, for the American Association of Zoo and Aquariums, research, broker and dealer, shelter, and then also transgenic aquatic species. Those are the present permits that we're allowed to go ahead and issue. What we're proposing is adding under the permit fees in 671.1b, adding an aquaculture permit in there. Basically, we'll read as mentioned on the screen. A person who is a resident can possess the qualifications as listed in 671.1, subparagraph C, subparagraph 1, to import, transport, and possess all these only species listed on the department-approved permit for aquaculture purposes or sales at a terminal market. And we realize that we're also going to be discussing additional restrictions in the aquaculture permit section of 671.7. And if you look at the entire 671 packages, some of the public comment letters that have come in mentioned 671.2b. If you look at 671.2 to 671.5, they're primarily developed for birds and mammals, and we feel those should be applicable in an aquaculture permit procedure. So basically, the possible revisions we're looking at for 671.7 are just basically adding the word sales, aquaculture permit, aquaculture animals into that existing regulation, and also clarifying aquaculture products as clarified in Section 17 of Fish and Game Code. And then we're also looking at developing additional measures for importation, transportation, possession, sales, similar to other permits in accordance with the aquaculture industry assistance. And with that, I'll leave it open for questions.
Any questions? Do we have any public speakers? No questions? Public speakers.
Oh, Sonke has a...
Sonke.
Yeah, we should have introduced this a little better. I just want to make it clear that the rulemaking before you is simply an issue of what species you're going to add to the restricted species. And one of those, Barramundi, is something, as you've heard by us testify, we want you to add to that for very good reasons. What Scott got into here as previous testimony is if the commission would like to make allowances down the road here for aquaculturists to use one of these restricted species in their operations, what Scott just described is some of the ways we would have to consider to allow for that for a species that's restricted. Just to be clear, we're not proposing doing that here today. It's just if you want to consider that, we'd have to go down that path. And he was just highlighting kind of some of the features that might be considered.
I appreciate that, Sonke, and I appreciate the presentation. It certainly goes directly to the concern that I had about adding a species like Barramundi to a restricted species with no provision to farm, to authorize aquaculture. And this would presumably also allow us to adopt reasonable and necessary restrictions on aquaculture operations to make sure that these animals didn't get released into the environment,
right,
and so forth. And you, yes, would presumably work with the California Aquaculture Association in developing those restrictions and protocols.
Yes, yeah. You've got it exactly right.
Yep. Okay. Public speakers. Any further comment?
No. H. Roy Gordon, followed by Mark Drawbridge.
Anyone that sat through this whole session this morning should be very impressed with the balance and leadership of this particular commission. I am certainly one of them. I'm Roy Gordon. I'm on two of the department's committees, two department committees, one being aquaculture disease, the other being aquaculture development. I'm an advisor to the California Aquaculture Association, and through my company, Fish Tech, Inc., I'm an advisor to wild fisheries and aquaculture worldwide. Scott's presentation is certainly a big start in the right direction to understanding how aquaculture fits in with the whole 671 section. Some in the department have been trying to put a round hole into a square peg and vice versa for a lot of years. I see light that things are coming together. For example, the logging requirements of 671.1b require for aquaculture to tag and each individual fish. Well, our industry has spawns of thousands and hundreds of thousands of fish. It virtually eliminates aquaculture from a participant. I feel very strongly that the 671 provisions are excellent, and we need to protect our waterways and our wild and our native fish. The key is that we understand what's happening to aquaculture and new things in aquaculture today. The particular proposal that started this is one of the new kinds of aquaculture, which deals with closed or semi-closed systems that are not dealing with the state's waterways. Aquaculture today on a worldwide basis deals with large production, thousands and thousands of tons along freeways in factory buildings, nowhere near the streams or waterways. And part of aquaculture's growth in California is going to be in that direction, and it's certainly something that Fish and Game can address because each application is the key. The key is the application and what are the conditions of that application, and Fish and Game look at that application, not species-related, but the conditions as to how the fish are grown, not the species. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Mark Drawbridge.
Yes, good afternoon now, commissioners. My name is Mark Drawbridge. I'm the president of the California Aquaculture Association. I'll keep my presentation here brief. As you know from the last commission meetings and prior commission meetings, we've been watching this evolution of this in relation to Barramundi quite carefully. We've had some concerns along the way. I documented some of those concerns in a letter to the commission earlier in November. With that said, we were very encouraged by the dialogue we had at the last meeting in November, both from the commission side and also from the department. Specifically, what we sensed was a genuine commitment to make this work, which is really what we're looking for, because we certainly believe that these species can be grown in California in a responsible manner. To follow up with that, I was further encouraged. I had a conversation with Sankey earlier this week where he kind of outlined the plan that was presented earlier, and it makes a lot of sense to us. The landscape has changed. We recognize that. We recognize and respect the department's situation relative to needing to control invasive species, and we're willing to do our part in that regard. This is, you know, we're in it for the long term, so we need to make and set some policies that are going to work down the road. As I mentioned in my testimony last November, what we're looking for is to really understand the rules, and it seems like the rules are changing, but it looks like those are going to be defined through this process. So I guess the remaining concerns that we would have now is just not fully understanding what's going to come downstream and how long that's going to take. As you know, we have some members that are eager to apply for some of these species right now. So if there's a way we can put a timeline together, we would certainly appreciate that. In my phone conversation with Sankey, he mentioned some possibilities for perhaps piggybacking this on with the PEIR process that's ongoing. We would certainly welcome that as an opportunity. There's still a gap with an aquaculture coordinator for the department. We recognize that this particular person, when they do come on board, is going to need to spearhead this effort. So those are my comments regarding that. Again, CAA stands at the ready to do whatever we can to help. We're thankful that it's been mentioned already that we will be given the opportunity to contribute to the process. To follow up on one other comment that Vice President Gustafson mentioned at the end of the last meeting, was perhaps a need or desire for the commission to get more educated on aquaculture. That's another area that the California Aquaculture Association would be very happy to help with in any way we can. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Roberts. That's the last speaker. Okay. We have a proposed motion.
Yes. Suggest.
Any questions?
No.
Okay. Go ahead.
Suggested motion, the Fish and Game Commission, pursuant to authority vested by Sections 2118 and 2120 of the Fish and Game Code, and to implement, interpret, and make specific Sections 1002 and several,
several other sections between 1002 and 3005.92 of said code, hereby amend Section 671, Title 14, related to importation, transportation, and possession of live-restricted animals. Please note the regulatory language will be included as an appendix in the Commission of Office Master Minutes.
Do I hear that motion?
So moved.
Second? Anyone?
Second.
Just to get a discussion going.
Okay. Do I hear a discussion?
Just a, I'll certainly support this motion under the condition that the department proceed with its development of aquaculture permit requirements as we've discussed. I just noted that this morning it was announced that Australis Aquaculture, which is the biggest producer of barramundi in the United States in Massachusetts, about 2 million pounds a year in Massachusetts in a closed recirculating system, won a big sustainability award, special award for the environment. So if it can be done in Massachusetts by this company, it you would certainly think it could be done here under appropriate safeguards. So I'd just like to see that proceed apace.
Mr. Keller?
Just, I've got some reservations. We just embattled a major deal for an endangered species in the state of California earlier today. And this commission is being accused while we sit here in the court system of allowing a non-native species to deplete another endangered species in the state of California. And I'm hesitant to be a part of approving any more non-native species in any form in this state with all the problems we're having presently with non-native species eliminating and species that are actually already on the endangered list in the state of California.
Okay. Commissioner Gustin, do you want to make
I tend to share Commissioner Kellogg's concerns. And I think the discussion on aquaculture needs to take that into account. I think not only the education, but also the philosophical issues of what are we trying to accomplish? You know, do we need to do this with non-natives versus some of the exhibits we've seen? And when we visited Scripps, it was great. We got to see some actual operations. But I remain concerned. And I will just express that for the record, so staff sees that there's I did have a wonderful dinner of barramundi recently. It was offered at a local restaurant, and I tried it. It was delicious, but I'm not sure that the risk factors involved. I would need to weigh this very, very carefully, especially in light of the pike. I mean that's just the most recent example, let alone the smelt.
If we can allow John to clarify this motion, however, I agree entirely with everyone's concerns about invasive non-native species. John?
Can I just interrupt? I think we're both aware that that isn't what's on the table today, but sometimes when we don't speak up at a commission meeting, staff of the department, the public think that we're all moving forward with we're going to approve something easily, and I don't want to give that misperception. So I know it's not the motion today, but I want to make sure we've stated that.
Yeah, we prior to you, Commissioner, being on here, we had a similar situation a few years back with something called a glowfish.
Well, I caught a little of that one, Jim.
Just to be clear, I share your sympathies entirely about the dangers inherent in non-native species. There are two other thoughts that come to mind. First of all, aquaculture is the most rapidly growing food production method in the world. We're not going to eliminate aquaculture. Our challenge is to green it and, you know, make it environmentally sustainable. And barramundi is a leading example of that, where it's grown with virtually no risk to the environment. Now, if we were talking about aquaculture of a non-native species in an open net pen, like salmon farming, for example, I would be the first to champion the prohibition of that. In fact, it is prohibited already in California. So I'm only suggesting that we ever approve an aquaculture permit requirement under the under very strict environmental safeguards.
Well, I echo everyone's commentary. I agree entirely. That's quite true. This, however, is a different issue. So.
Done.
Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Unanimous. Consent calendar?
I'm sorry, Mr. President. I do need to depart at this point. I'm sorry, but I know I'm leaving the rest of the business in three good hands here.
Thank you.
Consent calendar? Yes, I have a suggested motion on consent calendar.
Go ahead and make the motion, and then suggest the motion, and we can go from there.
The Fish and Game Commission hereby approves its December 7, 2007 consent calendar, items numbers 19 through 22. Suggested motion from staff.
Do I hear a second?
Second.
All those any discussion? All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Unanimous.
And then that brings us to announcement of future meetings. Our next meeting is actually December 17th. That is a teleconference meeting that will originate from the 13th floor conference room in the Resources Building in Sacramento. The agenda for that is posted on our website. And then we will have a full meeting on February 7th and 8th of 2008 in San Diego. That information will be posted on our web. And we have a joint meeting with the BRTF on February 13th.
Okay. And that's it, isn't it? Any further comments or questions or from any of the commissioners? Sankey, anything in the department? Do I hear a motion to adjourn?
Second.
All those in favor? All right. We're out of here. Thank you very much, everyone, for your participation in the meeting. And for those of you who are watching on the web, thank you very much.